Today TV with Cam Edwards.
Good Friday to you. Thank you so much for tuning in to another edition of Cam and Company, fueled by our friends at Hornady Ammunition. Coming to you once again from beautiful downtown Farmville, Virginia, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, so glad that you have joined us today. We've got a great show for you. Here in about 20 minutes or so, Mr. Ed Morrissey of Hot Air will be with us on the program talking about some of the big stories of the week. We'll not be able to get to them all, but we'll get to a few of them anyway. Chuck Howell later on in the hour joining us from the Oregon Trail Shooting Range. This was going to be one of our good guys earlier in the week. I ran across this story and I thought, you know, actually, I want to talk to these folks. This is really cool because, you know, look, gun control advocates, they have nothing right now other than attacking gun owners, right? We're supposed to be cruel, heartless, cold, uncaring. We love our guns more than our kids, right? I mean, that's what they have, is to try to smear us like that. When in reality, gun owners are parents. We're animal lovers. Some of us hunt, some of us don't. But, you know, most of us love critters. In fact, I got a couple new ones to show you later. And out in Pocatello, Idaho, they actually held recently this event called Pistols for Pets, which was a day of shooting, a fundraiser for the local Humane Society, not the Humane Society of the United States, which is very anti-hunting and very anti-gun, but the local Humane Society. Really cool idea. And apparently the response was really good. So we're going to talk with Chuck Howell about that later on in the hour. Maybe something that, you know, we can do for our local shelters around the country, right? If they can do it in Pocatello, Idaho, there's no reason why we can't do it in Valdosta, Georgia, or up in, I don't know, somewhere in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Scott Box is going to be with us in Hour 3 from the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs. We'll talk about the latest from Trenton. Also, Frank Miniter from America's First Freedom writing at Fox News on Brett Kavanaugh. He says brings clear reasoning to the Second Amendment, and that's why liberals are freaking out. Jazz Shaw of Hot Air will be with us in Hour 3 as well. We'll talk about the latest going on in New York 21, Tedrick Cobb and the Post Star. Julie Kelly of American Greatness is going to be with us as well. Talk about the 12 Russians accused of hacking Democrats in the 2016 election. The indictments handed down by Rod Rosenstein earlier today. Plus, we have our hero of the day. We have our deal of the day. We have our good guy of the day. We've got all of the day's top Second Amendment news and information. I want to talk about a few things here in this first segment, including an update from New York 21 in this Tedrick Cobb story. Tedrick Cobb, the Democratic candidate who was caught on tape telling a group of young gun control supporters, you know, I support an assault weapons ban, but I can't say it publicly. I was at a luncheon and a woman asked me, do you support banning these guns? And I said, yes, I do, but I can't say that. And she said, well, I wish you would. And she said, well, I can't. I'll lose the election. And Moms Demand Action, a volunteer told me, if you say that, you'll lose the election. So this story comes out earlier in the week. The audio and the video of this comes out earlier in the week. Then it comes out that just a few days earlier, Tedrick Cobb, the Democratic candidate there in New York 21, had actually taken this pledge from the Post Star newspaper, not to lie. It was the paper's no lie pledge. There it is. Cobb takes paper's no lies pledge. Tedrick Cobb, I've run my campaign with honesty and integrity from the very beginning. That won't change now. And then, you know, she's out there saying, I can't tell people what I really think about a gun ban because then I won't win. So she's very studiously avoided talking about this issue, both before and in public, by the way, both before this tape came out and after. Her post release of this video response has basically been, you know, it's a moot point anyway, because it wouldn't pass in Congress, which is not this. I mean, are you saying that, yeah, you do actually support it, but you just think it doesn't matter because it, right? And then Moms Demand said, no, we didn't actually tell her not to support a gun ban publicly because it would cost her the election. I mean, because, you know, Moms Demand Action is out there trying to sell this narrative that we can talk about gun control. And then here's this candidate, a Democrat, saying, I can't talk about gun control. Yeah. So, I mean, it's gotten weird. And then yesterday, the Post Star newspaper, the paper that had this no lie pledge, they come out with an editorial and it's all about, you need to be honest, Elise Stefanik. That's the Republican running in New York 21. And the editorial even like cites, you know, Tedra Cobbs, she took our no-lie pledge. You haven't done so yet. And they don't even talk about Tedra Cobb taking that pledge and then it coming out that she told these gun control supporters, I have a position that I can't publicly reveal because it would cost me the election because voters wouldn't like that opinion that I have. I mean, it was amazing. And so then last night, after we're off the air, Cameron sends me a link to another column from the Post-Star newspaper. Headline, this is no way to run a campaign. And so I'm thinking, all right, the paper had a editorial that you know, completely ignored the issue, but they allowed a columnist to actually write about, okay, this is no way to run a campaign. You don't take a no-lies pledge, and as it turns out, you're not being honest with voters. Oh, no, I was wrong. I was wrong. Will Doolittle, the project's editor at the Post-Star newspaper, quote, I went to YouTube and I watched the two videos, Tedra Cobb Teen Talk Parts 1 and 2, that the Stefanik campaign is trying to make notorious, and I was embarrassed for the teen who made them and angry at the adults who encouraged him. No word on how he felt about Tedra Cobb actually telling these gun control advocates, oh, yeah, you know, I support a gun ban, but I can't say it publicly. That never comes up in this column. Ever. Nope. Instead, Doolittle says that each video shows a small group of people sitting around a porch in the first video, maybe under a pavilion in the second, chatting about political issues and gossiping about other candidates, the people who work for them. Tedra Cobb is there in both videos. Everyone's a little awkward. Cobb mentions something about this guy who is, I guess, the tracker, who was taping earlier at an event. No, he says, and says that his phone is dead. Teens, Doolittle writes, have to take responsibility for their actions, but adults have to guide them. It's too bad Grayson, apparently this tracker, decided to be sneaky, but it's disgraceful that the people in Elise Stefanik's campaign have encouraged him. Now, I don't know if any of that's true or not. I don't know if Mr. Doolittle knows whether or not that's true or not. He writes, if they seized on the video as a way to attack Tedra Cobb, which they did, that is disgraceful too. This isn't to catch a predator. This is a candidate in a congressional primary sitting around and nibbling on snacks with teenagers who she thinks are supporters. Uh-huh. Here's the thing. You can like or dislike this, but trackers have become a standard part of I'm not so sure that I really like it, but trackers have become a standard part of political campaigns on the left and the right for, who would you say, Cameron? It's 2018, at least 12 years, right?
Yeah. When I was working at POTUS 08, before this job, we were on Sirius XM, we tracked the presidential election then. We were even talking about it then, and we sent out reporters. We did, personally. This is, you know, regardless of the campaign, so yes, but at least 12 years.
Okay, so again, whether you like it or not, this is what's happening. And Mr. Doolittle's entire column is about, oh, this shouldn't happen, this is outrageous. And he just kind of doesn't ever get around to the candidate who, look, regardless of how you feel about trackers, how do you feel about a candidate who, when she thinks she's just with supporters, says, yeah, I have this position, but I can't talk about it publicly. Because if I do, I won't win the election. And I may go and I may vote for this. I may go vote for this gun ban when I get up there. But I can't say that. Or I won't get there. It's bizarre to me that the Post... here's the thing. It's not really bizarre to me. My suspicion is that the Post-Star editorial board leans left and supports Tedra Cobb and wants to endorse Tedra Cobb and therefore doesn't really want to talk about how this no-lies pledge is kind of blown up in their face. Their latest story, by the way, just out, Representative Stefanik takes no-lies pledge. This is from Michael Goot of the Post-Star. Let's see, I'm just looking here. Stefanik's tweet was part of a series she made on her personal Twitter account Thursday in response to the release of a video in which Cobb was recorded secretly in May at a Teens for Tedra event at a house.
Cobb was relating a question she received at a luncheon about whether she supports an assault weapons ban. On the video, she said that she told the person that she was in favor of a ban but could not say that and get elected. National Republican officials have seized on the video to attack Cobb. And again, that's the narrative, right? It's just, well, we'll note that it happened. And then, can you believe these attacks? Stefanik herself followed suit in a series of tweets saying, quote, this election is a clear choice. My opponent says one thing in private and another in public. Just days after pledging to be honest with voters, my opponent was caught on camera saying she must lie to voters in order to get elected. For example, I support the Second Amendment. It's clear that my opponent does not. Hashtag New York 21. From day one, I have proudly served our district with a commitment to transparency and openness. Whether you agree or disagree on policy issues, you know where I stand and share, and I share how I vote. Working to earn the support of Congress at the ballot box means that the most important pledge of honesty and integrity is to the people, not the papers. And the people is to whom I pledge honesty and integrity, representing New York 21. The Post Star has a little addendum to the story. Very last paragraph. Tedra Cobb issued a statement Wednesday to the Watertown Times saying that in the video she was speaking with students who had a very real fear of gun violence. She said that she was talking to them about truth and the inability for the political system to talk about issues and solutions without politics getting in the way. That may have been the backdrop. That doesn't actually explain away anything that she actually said, if you note that. But anyway, we'll talk about this with Jazz Shaw. You're now caught up. Tedra Cobb would love for this story to go away. I think so would the Post Star newspaper. And it's now, I think, what is this, Cameron? Day three, right? Day three of this. Be a nice story, at least in the area, and I think among gun owners there in New York State, this is certainly a story. So we'll talk about it with Jazz Shaw coming up in hour three. Now we got a couple of minutes left, and it's Friday. I want to have a little fun here. So I mentioned we've got some new critters at the farm. We have barn cats for the very first time, and this is the first time I've ever had cats. These, I can't tell you their names because we haven't named them yet. It's still very much up for discussion. The cute little tortie. And then our black cat. We have two cats. We have three kids at the house. And every kid wants to name the cats. So I'm not really sure how that works. I have been told by a couple of cat owners that my kids could come up with their own names for the cats. And it wouldn't really matter because cats don't really come when they're called anyway. So have you ever had cats, Cameron? Would that work? I mean, that wouldn't work with a dog. But
I don't know. But Katie's behind me and she says yes.
Yeah? So they could just have their own names because it doesn't really matter.
Yep. Katie. Emphatic yes from Katie.
All right. Well, we'll see how this goes. I've never considered myself a cat person, but I did find myself scritching little kitty ears this morning before I went to work. So, yeah, how about that? And then I got to work, and I got on Twitter, and I saw Stephen Gutowski had tweeted this out. The Brady campaign actually using me in a fundraising email, yes, accusing me of mansplaining Judge Brett Kavanaugh's views on the Second Amendment. Yes, dear Stephen, the NRA continues to celebrate Judge Kavanaugh's appointment to replace Justice Kennedy on the Supreme Court. We must be doing something right because NRA TV's Cam Edwards called me out by name to explain that Judge Kavanaugh's Second Amendment position is, quote, crystal clear. And then underneath, the caption actually is about me mansplaining. I don't know what makes it mansplaining, but apparently I'm mansplained. So I do just kind of want to revisit the position of Avery Gardner, the vice president of the Brady campaign. And because it's not me mansplaining. She's wrong about what the Supreme Court has said. And I think that regardless, look, whether you want every gun control law that you can think of to become law or, you know, you want constitutional carry in all 50 states, I think it's important that we actually know what the Supreme Court has said. And that we base our, I mean, even if you're a gun control argument or a gun control advocate, I want you to base your arguments on the facts. I want to actually start from that shared position of, okay, we can agree that the Supreme Court actually wrote this. And Avery Gardner's just getting it wrong. But I don't want to be accused of mansplaining. So I thought what we could do, Cameron, is maybe we could let the kittens explain. Can we put the kittens up real quick, just one more time? We could kittensplain. There you go. You can just flash back and forth between the two if you want. But, okay. Meow, let's get started. And, so if you, can we see that first graphic, meow, of the quote with Avery Gardner of the Brady campaign? Could we put that up, meow, on the screen? Just the first bit of text. I'm still seeing the cat. Sorry. All right. Well, hang on. My computer screen has frozen me out, so we have to wait here just for 1 second. Okay. Whoop. Nope. That's the wrong one. Oh, doggone it. This was going to be so much better. Okay. Oh, I found it, meow. Okay. So in this Mother Jones article, Avery Gardner of the Brady campaign says, what we know about his stances is through the opinions he's issued on assault weapons, meow. A challenge to D.C.'s ban on assault weapons went before him and two other judges. All three were appointed by Republicans. The panel split 2-1 to uphold the law, meow, and Judge Kavanaugh is the dissenter. He thinks assault weapons are within the scope of the Second Amendment, meow, which puts him way out of step with the Supreme Court and circuit courts that have considered this issue. The Second Amendment protects the kinds of weapons that were in, quote, common use at the time, meow, in 1791 when the Second Amendment was adopted. Those are former Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia's words, meow. Judge Kavanaugh just uses the first part of that phrase. So she says that Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia said the Second Amendment protects the kinds of weapons that were in common use at the time in 1791, meow. Okay, now let's actually look at what the Supreme Court said. This is the Supreme Court talking, meow, in the Catano case, which the court unanimously decided about 6 weeks after Justice Antonin Scalia passed away. So this was an 8-0 guidance to the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, the state of Massachusetts' highest court, meow. The court has held, meow, that the Second Amendment extends prima facie to all instruments that constitute bearable arms, even those that were not in existence at the time of the founding, meow. And that this Second Amendment right is fully applicable to the states, meow. Okay, so, kiddies, I think we can put you guys back in the bar now. I think you're done kitty explaining. Thank you very much for the kitten explaining there. And, you know, look, this is what they've got. As I said, this is what the gun control groups have. They provided a link, I think, to the video where we talked about this. So hopefully maybe some of the Brady supporters actually watched and realized, huh, that isn't really what she said, is it? Because, again, I think regardless of where we stand on the gun control side of the debate, you're a gun control supporter, you're a Second Amendment supporter, you believe that we should try to call gun control gun safety because it'll help you along. Regardless of where you stand, we should at least be able to look at what the Supreme Court said and go from there, right? And not cherry pick, but actually look at everything the Supreme Court has said and go from there. All right, we're going to take a quick timeout. When we come back, Ed Morrissey of Hot Air joins us on the program. Chuck Howell of the Oregon Trail Shooting Range in Pocatello, Idaho, talking about shooters saving animals over the past weekend and how you might be able to do something like that in your neck of the woods. Stick around. We've got much more Cam and Company coming up next, meow.
Let me ask you a simple question. Do you believe you have a right to defend yourself and your family with a firearm in your own home? 4 Supreme Court justices say you do, but 4 say you don't, because the deciding vote announced he's retiring. And your most fundamental right to self-defense could be extinguished. This is our opportunity to protect the one freedom that guarantees all the others, the freedom that makes America different from every other country on earth. The Second Amendment is at stake. America is at stake. We are the last place on earth that still believes in the fundamental God-given right of self-defense. And we don't care if we're the last ones in the arena. We will never, ever stop fighting for this freedom. We're the National Rifle Association of America, and we're freedom's safest place.
Fans are super patriotic. We love that. Our fans are loyal, patriotic, and I have a brother that's in the military, so that kind of really is close to home for us.
Thank you to the men and women out there fighting for our freedom. We wouldn't be here today doing what we do and driving race cars and being able to live out the dreams of our lives if it wasn't for you. So thank you for keeping our freedom free and fighting for all of us.
Bristol Motor Speedway. The place where you can forget about work for a while. Celebrate the good old USA. And take in the best bumper banging, fist waving, hero making short track race of the year. The Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race. It's America's night race. This is what you live for. So be there August 18th. It ain't just another race. It's Bristol, baby.
Here at the SCI convention with our good friend Larry Potterfield from Midway USA. Larry, it's good to see you, sir.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
So before we start talking about Midway, I want to talk about the foundation. We were at SHOT Show last week. We interviewed people from the Midway USA Foundation. It's part of something that you at Midway are very passionate about. It's giving back and donations and helping youth shooting sports. Talk about that. Why is that important to you?
Well, as Brenda and I got to where we could start giving away money, then obviously you have to figure out where you're going to give it. Lots of people will take your money, but where can you put it that's where you'd like to have it? And we thought that one of the places that we needed money was in high school and college shooting teams. And so there wasn't any money for them, but there were a lot of shooting teams. So the Midway USA Foundation was created specifically to help high school and college shooting teams raise money for their teams. And there's about 2,300 teams now that have endowed money in the Midway USA Foundation. They draw 5% a year. We give about $5 million out twice a year to those high school and college shooting teams as grant money.
You know, you're wearing the NRA Golden Ring of Freedom jacket, signifying the amazing amount of money that you've donated to the NRA. You have the NRA Roundup, for the NRA Foundation, NRA ILA. Why is the NRA itself so important to you?
Well, let me say, first of all, that the NRA gave me this jacket because Brenda and I gave him a lot of money. She has a jacket also. And so I wear it, and I introduce it, telling people that I hope they'll get a jacket also. So the NRA, we wouldn't be here talking today if it weren't for the NRA. So the question again was, now I forgot.
Why is the NRA so personally so important to you?
Well, here's the Safari Club show. I don't think that it would be here if it weren't for the NRA. So if you look at that Second Amendment and you think, what's the most important thing for everything? And the Second Amendment really is the foundation, I think, that all the other key conservation groups are built on.
This is the Safari Club International. We're filled with the big hunters, anglers from all around the world. Why is this is an important show? And talk about the state of hunting right now. How is the state of the hunting industry?
You know, we've got a lot of work to do in the future. To reestablish the hunting community is what I would say. That's work that Safari Club will do, work that the NRA will do. That's really kind of an expanding mission of the NRA to put emphasis on hunting, because if no one wants to hunt, then there'll be certainly less interest in guns in the future.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Cam Edwards, your host. Glad to have you with us today. Coming up about an hour from now, Frank Miniter joins us from America's First Freedom Writing for Fox News about Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court. Right now we have Mr. Ed Morrissey of Hot Air joining us on the program. Ed, good day, sir.
Good day to you. Great to be on with you.
It is good talking with you. I'm going to give you, I want to start with Brett Kavanaugh, and I will sum up the week of Brett Kavanaugh news in two quotes. Monday night, Chuck Schumer: I will oppose Brett Kavanaugh's nomination with everything that I have. Friday, West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin: I'll be 71 years old in August, and you're going to whip me? Kiss my you-know-what. That's Joe Manchin's response when asked if Schumer can influence his vote. So, as I said to Chuck Schumer on Twitter Monday night, you have nothing. And it looks like, you know, almost a week in here, Ed, Schumer does have something. He has a real headache on his hands,
right?
Because he doesn't necessarily have the votes, but he has a base that is so angry that they're not reasonable. I mean, you had Dick Durbin say earlier this week, these people don't understand how the rules of the Senate work. He's right. They don't, and they don't care.
Well, and in large part because the same base forced them to change the rules of the Senate in order to slam through appellate jurists in 2013. And then they decided that they wanted to filibuster Neil Gorsuch to replace Antonin Scalia in order to try to exact some revenge over the abandonment of Merrick Garland by the Senate the year before, and gave Mitch McConnell a perfect opportunity to change the rules yet again so that the filibuster doesn't apply to Supreme Court nominations when he still had 52 Republicans that were willing to support Donald Trump. And that is a miscalculation of a gigantic nature. And it's that same base that's driving those decisions. And it's the same base that's going to drive it right now. You have Brian Fallon, who is Hillary Clinton's former press secretary for the campaign, who is now running a group called Demand Justice, which is a group dedicated to blocking Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation to the Supreme Court. They're going to spend $5 million on ads running against red state Democrats like Joe Manchin, Joe Donnelly, Heidi Heitkamp. The only way you can describe this is an effort to make sure that Republicans have 55 or 56 votes in the Senate for the next Supreme Court nomination. I mean, they're literally shooting themselves in the foot. Well, I don't want to say literally. That's a Biden literally. They're almost literally shooting themselves in the foot and basically working on marginalizing themselves in an election that they really should have a pretty good time in.
Well, so it's interesting, you know, and you and I both tell our audience, take polls with grains of salt. They're not perfect snapshots. Yeah. But there was a poll that came out, I think it was a SurveyMonkey Axios poll that came out earlier this week that showed not great news for Democrats. I mean, if you're looking at a blue wave here, there wasn't much evidence of that in the Senate a survey. What it showed was that, you know, there were some bright spots for Democrats. Like, I think the Democrat in Arizona was up over any Republican challenger right now. The Democrat in Nevada, I think, had like a 3-point lead over the Republican. But there were bad news in that polls for a lot of these red state Democrats that you talk about, like Joe Donnelly, Heidi Heitkamp, Joe Manchin. Well, Manchin, I think, was up in this poll. But basically, if you're a red state Democrat, you're endangered right now. Your political future is in jeopardy.
Yeah, Bill Nelson was in Florida was actually the other one that was in trouble. I think he was five points down to Rick Scott. But you got to take a look at the Arizona and Nevada thing too in their context. Arizona hasn't had its primary yet, so they're polling Kristen Sinema against three different Republicans in a split field. So when the Republicans actually finally nominate somebody, it's probably going to be Martha McSally. Then I think the polling, you can start taking that polling seriously. And Dean Heller only being down 3 points in Nevada is actually a pretty good outcome for Dean Heller at the moment. He has been far and away considered the weakest Republican incumbent in this upcoming election. So I think that that's actually not bad news for Republicans. And my guess is that with the abolish ICE talk, with all of the talk about assault weapons bans and all that type of stuff, you're looking at the potential for some significant erosion in the Senate races. Now, the House races are tougher to say because it just the numbers are in a midterm election are usually going to run against the president no matter what. But I think that the balance of the seats that are being contested in the Senate wasn't good news for Democrats to begin with. And I wouldn't be surprised with everything that's going on now with Democrats trying to take aim at the red state incumbents that they need to protect, that you might be seeing something like a 5 or 6 seat pickup at the end, you know, at the end of the midterm elections here for Republicans.
And we'll see, as you say, the House races, you know, and a lot of those House races are going to turn on local issues. It's going to be there's going to be a lot of stuff that the national media just doesn't really pick up on. You know, there's been some interesting stuff with like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez winning the nomination, and now she's out there promoting, you know, the far left Democratic Socialist candidates in primaries that have yet to occur, as opposed to supporting the candidates that are supported by the, you know, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. And there's some hand-wringing going on among Democrats about, you know, okay, she's going to get elected to Congress. Why isn't she falling in line now? She has to understand now she's a statesperson. And so this is, I mean, we're going to see this rift in the Democrat Party play out between now and Election Day. And it's going to be really interesting, I think, in some of these primaries going forward because, you know, this young class that's coming up, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, clearly the leader as proclaimed by the media, if nothing else, they don't, you know, Nancy Pelosi's not going to keep her job. You know, the entire leadership is out. They feel like those folks are old and calcified and they want to be the ones in charge. They're not going to sit around and wait 20 years to get seniority. They're going to have a coup.
Well, I think that's you're already starting to see that. Tim Ryan says that now that Joe Crowley's out, that was the person who got defeated by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, that he might take another run at the caucus leadership position. He lost a challenge. I think it was 4 years ago to Nancy Pelosi. He's talking about staging another another run at it now because of Crowley's departure, at leaving a big hole in the Democratic leadership. But I would say that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's danger to the Democrats is possibly not even – it's possibly broader than what – than what you think it is. There was a new poll that came out a couple of days ago, but wasn't much noticed until today from the Washington Post talking about border security. And remember, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is the one who really championed this abolish ICE movement that people like Elizabeth Warren, Kirsten Gillibrand, Cory Booker, and some other mainstream Democrats picked up and ran with. And you take a look at the polling on this, and for battleground voters, this is the Washington Post poll. For battleground voters, when they're asked to choose between who they trust more on border security, Donald Trump or Democrats in Congress, Donald Trump wins by 20 points, 45-25 among voters in battleground states. It's 10 points overall, by the way, but 20 points difference between Trump and Democrats in the battleground states, battleground districts. And I think that that's I mean, I really honestly think that they have way overplayed their hand. And you take a look at some of the rest of the polling in that Washington Post poll, that there's broad support for border enforcement. There's broad support for family detention as opposed to catch and release. These are majority positions, not just overall, but among independents, among African-Americans. It's a kind of a tie score between on Hispanics. Both men and women agree on this. And I think that Democrats are painting themselves into a very extreme corner by listening to the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's of their party, and may have parked themselves in a cul-de-sac here close enough to the midterms for it to matter.
You know, I think you're right about that. And your colleague Alla Pundit has a piece at Hot Air just went up a couple of minutes ago talking about this bill that three Democrats introduced in the House to abolish ICE. And this is, you know, yes, they introduced this as a campaign stunt, and they got called on it. And, the GOP said, okay, we can vote on this. Let's have a vote on abolishing ICE. Now they said, no. Okay. We're going to vote no, because this is a stunt that the GOP is pulling, holding a vote. And let me ask you a question. If you get elected to Congress and you write legislation and you introduce legislation, isn't the point of that to get a vote? Isn't that what you're going for?
Yes. Clearly, that wasn't what Mark Pocan was going for. I actually wrote about this, Pocan's bill, about it a week and a half ago at the Daily Beast. And I got a couple things incorrect about that. And I got a sort of a nasty gram from Pocan's office, which was fair because I had misinterpreted one of the provisions of that. So we went back and corrected that. But the bill made no sense even with the correction, because what they wanted to do was they wanted to split up all the different functions of ICE, move them out to different organizations that really don't have anything to do with border security, and then spend the next 18 months having a 17-person commission, apparently chew on what kind of organization needs to replace ICE, when the issue that is really in front of them is changing the law to fit whatever enforcement pattern you want. The problem is that ICE is enforcing the law as it's written with the court precedent that's in place, the court settlement, Flores being the court settlement that's in place. And so they're running into basically a conundrum in dealing with arrests at the border when children are involved. And it's up to Congress to deal with that by changing the statutes so that it reflects what Congress's will is. Now, if Mark Pocan wanted to do that, that certainly would make some sense. But just saying we're going to wipe out ICE, wait 18 months, and then figure out what we're going to do about border security is insane. It's absolutely insane. And that's the reason why Democrats are running away from this bill, is because it was really only intended just as a sop to the Ocasio-Cortez's of the party.
Yeah. But, again, I mean, that's the thing. If that's the sop, and an absolutely unworkable bill that does absolutely nothing. I mean, like, if okay, so that's the best you got. You're just throwing it out there. Here's what we're working for, and that's what you give them. I mean, you know, that it's just amazing to me, Ed. Anyway, listen, we're out of time, unfortunately. I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. Enjoy the wonderful Minnesota summer. Hopefully, the mosquitoes don't carry you away, and we will look forward to talking to you again very soon.
Sounds great. Good talking with you again.
All right. Thank you so much, Ed Morrissey. Join us from Hot Air. And coming up in Hour 3, Hot Air's Jazz Shaw will join us as well, talking about what's going on in New York 21. But after a quick timeout, we get to talk about puppy dogs and kitty cats and maybe even some bunnies. Because over the weekend in Pocatello, Idaho, the Pistols for Pets event was held at a local range. I love this. Local Second Amendment supporters, gun owners turning out, and actually an opportunity for people who were curious about shooting a gun for the very first time, showing up there at a local range, fundraiser for a local animal shelter. Sounds like a good time was had by all, and hopefully some pets' lives were saved. Stick around. We'll get to the bottom of this right after a quick timeout here on Cam and Company.
When I wrote God Bless USA in 1983 in the back of my bus, it was full of my heart. It was full of what I meant to say about where I came from. If tomorrow the things were gone, I'd work for all my life. I wanted to say I'm proud to be an American because I felt very proud of my country. And it had been a long time since I heard anybody say that. We're a melting pot of people who find it difficult to say something about all of us together collectively. And that's why I wanted to say I'm proud to be an American, whatever an American is. You know, it's from Japanese to Irish to English to German, you name it. We are Americans together. And lastly, I won't forget the men who died for our freedom. We do travel the world with God Bless the USA with the military. And I've done 30 USO tours. So no matter what country we're in, I'm usually under the safeguard of the United States military. And I've only come under fire a couple of times. And if every citizen in America knew that that's the kind of danger our troops are in, they'd have a little bit more respect for the danger, particularly this war on terror, which is more jungle warfare and desert warfare where you don't know where the enemy is and who they are. Well, everybody knows Bristol is a very different track than any other NASCAR track. Everybody has a beer cooler and they're dragging it into the stadium, and they know they're going to be there for a long time after the race. A lot of camaraderie, a lot of pre-race stuff, a lot of after-race stuff is kind of fun. And in the setting of East Tennessee, there in Bristol, where it's such surrounded by such beautiful stuff, thank God for sports events in this country. To see a night race there is a little special because I think you have to be engaged as a fan. At night, you kind of get the whole magic of it all, even if you're not a fan. The amount of people who believe that America is the greatest country on earth and are proud to display it at that track, oh my gosh, you just have to go to Bristol and see it. I mean, you know, there are bigger tracks, there are bigger arenas, but Bristol's the place to come and see the display of Americanism. Fantastic.
Speaking with Glenn Hoyer with the NRA Law Enforcement Division. Glenn, welcome back to the program. You've got an important piece of legislation you want to discuss. Tell us about it.
Hey, John, thank you for having me. I wanted to take the time to discuss the Law Enforcement Officer Safety Act, commonly called LEOSA or H.R. 218. This law was passed in 2004, signed in by President George W. Bush, and it has been a great law to assist law enforcement, both active and retired, but specifically the retired officers. This legislation allows officers who meet the qualifications, and that is to have proper credentials and have a yearly qualification and proof of such, to be able to carry a concealed firearm nationwide. There are some restrictions, but there's a lot of misinformation out there about the law, and most importantly, there's a lot of active duty officers who can come in contact with retired officers who don't know the law exists or what the parameters are. So we've been putting forth a great effort at NRA Law Enforcement and in conjunction with ILA and the attorney there, James Baranowski, to give some presentations to update officers who are retired about the law, as well as to departments who have the active duty officers that may encounter a retired officer and not understanding the law that passed and the fact they can carry concealed nationwide. So we've had great turnout for programs here at the annual meeting and at training conferences to law enforcement conferences around the country. But I would also urge active and retired officers to visit our website, le.nra.org, and check out LEOSA, being the upper left-hand corner. There's frequently asked questions, a copy of the law, and even some articles that have been written by James Baranowski, our attorney and expert on the matter.
Wow, it sounds like a good wealth of information about LEOSA. Once again, there's seminars and a website. What's that website again?
It's le.nra.org.
And check out the section on LEOSA.
That's correct. Law Enforcement Officer Safety Act, LEOSA.
Welcome back. It is Cam and Company right here on NRA TV. I have my Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race shirt on from last year. That's right, the Bat Bass Crossing, heading down to Bristol this weekend. I will be reporting back next week, and you can get your tickets for August 18th. That's this year's Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race at NRARaceTix.com.
I'm telling you, if you've never been there, it is absolutely amazing. It is gorgeous. We always have a great, great time. The crowd is fantastic. There's not a bad seat in the house. Literally, last year when we went down there, we went up to the highest point in the bowl of the Bristol Motor Speedway, the nosebleed section. And not only were there great sight lines, but you honestly, it's a half mile oval. You felt like you were right on top of the track at the highest point of the stadium. It's absolutely amazing. It's going to be a fantastic race. It is going to be such a good time. And we'll get a chance to see you there. All right. Want to welcome to the program from Pocatello, Idaho right now. Mr. Chuck Howell is with us from the Oregon Trail Shooting Range. Chuck, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well today.
Thank you so much for coming on the program. I saw this story. You know, I look through national news stories, local news stories each and every day, trying to bring folks the latest Second Amendment news and information. And this isn't, look, I understand, Chuck, this is not a huge story, but it's a cool story. It's a good story. And I'm so glad you could join us to talk about what gun owners are doing there in the Pocatello, Idaho area to help out one of the local animal shelters there.
Well, yeah, it was a kind of unique opportunity. I was contacted by a person that's recently moved into the community asking about a fundraising event at our range, and he called it Pistols for Pets, and he had to explain a little bit about what he was talking about. And I said, sure, the range would be glad to participate. You know, we provided, obviously, a place to shoot, steel targets, a range of safety officer. Several of us loaned out personal handguns. And then Greg put together the rest of it, and we had a really good turnout. Wasn't a huge amount of money raised, you know, but we got about $500 raised, and a large number of people came through, shot, and enjoyed the event.
And so did you have, I mean, I know that folks could go and they could pay a flat fee, and then you could go and you could shoot some donated pistols that were there. You had your range safety officers. Did you have folks who were new to shooting who showed up, Chuck? Was that primarily who were there?
I think we had some that were new to shoot. I don't want to say bad things about them, but based off of their inability to hit a lot of targets, they didn't have a lot of practice.
Okay. Well, hopefully they'll be back.
Yeah, I think so. You make it a friendly event, and they see the fun in that, and they want to do it again. And a lot of them were talking about, is this going to be an annual event? We hadn't really discussed it, but by the end of the event, I think we will be looking at doing this every year. And actually, thought is to expand next year into trying to get into a little bit more 22s, perhaps rifles, and focus a little bit more on the youth and try and get some more youth out there for that.
That's awesome. And then again, all the money raised went to the Bannock Humane Society. This is the local Humane Society, which is very different, of course, than HSUS. And it sounds like they were really pleased with the turnout and the success of the event as well.
They were. They are a local animal shelter, if you will. So any publicity they get that's positive is good for them. The money helps towards caring for the animals they have. And then there were a lot of retailers in town that provided donations. We had a local Ford dealership had brought out trucks. We had local police department sent a couple officers out and talked to people and stuff about kind of what they do. They were canine officers and stuff. So trying to make it a little bit more wider spread than just shooting. So we had the event. Gave away prizes, grand prize being a slightly used new 9mm. It was one of our guns that we were using to shoot with.
Slightly used. New that morning, used that afternoon. Well, Chuck,
right.
Again, Liz, I think it's so fantastic what you guys are doing there. And I know that according to the Idaho State Journal, you guys are doing a lot there at the Oregon Trail Shooting Range, including free class, first and third Wednesdays of every month, exclusively for women, all about basics of handling a handgun for self-defense. So I want to thank you for doing that. What's the turnout been like for those courses?
It's been pretty good. You know, kudos on that to Sam Clark of Idaho Combat Systems. He came to us and said, this is what I'd like to do, and we certainly are making the range available, that portion of the range that he's using in our clubhouse available. There seems to be anywhere from about 6 to 10 women at a time, and it varies. You know, they can't always make each event, but pretty good turnout every time, and that's real positive.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, Chuck, again, thank you so much, sir. Hopefully you have a great weekend and get in some range time this weekend.
Hi. Well, I got a 3-gun match at another range on tomorrow, so I'll be there.
Excellent. Chuck Howell joins from the Oregon Trail Shooting Range. Thank you so much, sir.
All right. Thank you.
And you can find out more about the shooting range there at gatecity.com. SSA. I was confused for a second, Cameron, because there is a Gate City, Virginia, which is actually down by Bristol.
Yeah, I had the same thought.
And so I was briefly confused about where exactly this was taking place, but there you go. Way out in Idaho, not southwestern Virginia. But I'll tell you a story out of southwestern Virginia. Not too far from Gate City, as a matter of fact. Lee County, Virginia, which is way, way southwest in the Appalachian Mountains. Next county over, you're in Kentucky. Last night, Lee County, Virginia School Board approved a measure allowing armed school staff there at county schools. First county in the state of Virginia to do so. Board members voting unanimously in support of this measure, according to WJHL. Michael Kidwell, chairman of the Lee County School Board, said the only way to fight a gun if somebody comes through these doors with a gun to shoot our students is with another gun. Board confirmed tonight that teachers will be armed starting this fall as soon as October. Now, here's the thing. We know that opponents of this, they've got a couple of claims. One, there's a claim that teachers don't want this. I guarantee you that's not going to be an issue in Lee County. I guarantee you that the teachers who volunteer for this program, who are vetted, there will probably be a surplus. There will probably be more teachers than the school board actually goes forward with this first time around. One of the other arguments that we hear all of the time is that they just, you know, they just get this emotional argument going, and then they just, the next thing you know, they just, and they approve it. They're not thinking this through. Lee County School Board says they've looked at this issue for more than a year. They've considered this for more than a year and has been met with majority support from both parents and teachers there in the school district who want to be prepared. School board member Rob Hines says, at least it gives us a chance. If we sat there and did nothing, I couldn't sleep at night. At least we're trying to do something. Here's the thing, though. They're not just, quote unquote, doing something. If it was just about doing something, I wouldn't be in support of it. This is about doing something concrete to protect those students in their care. Beth Davies, an educator who is against this program, said, quote, the more guns that are out there, the more problems we're going to have. The news didn't provide any more information than that. That's her objection. Now, actually, we know for a fact that over the past 25 years in this country, we've actually had more guns and less crime, so Beth might want to educate herself on what's actually happened here in this country over the last couple of decades. The board argues that this is the most financially viable option for keeping kids safe, as the district cannot afford school resource officers and metal detectors in every school. This is something else that we've talked about. And again, Lee County is a rural county. I've driven through Lee County. There's no major metropolitan area there. This is going to be very, very difficult to, you know, fund. They've got, I think, 11 schools there in Lee County. On any given day, I doubt that there are 11 Lee County sheriff's deputies on duty at one time. So the idea of putting school resource officers in every school is not feasible. It's not going to happen. This is feasible. And this is going to happen. WJHL says many Lee County teachers have already volunteered to be considered for the role of being an armed school staffer. One former teacher told Channel 11 that most teachers would be willing to go face-to-face with a gunman if it meant saving one of their students. Ronald Early, former Lee County school teacher and principal, said sooner or later it could happen. And like some of the school board members said tonight, we need to be prepared if it does. The firearms and training will be paid for by the school district. WJHL says those teachers who are selected by the school will go through a strict application, screening, and training process before they are allowed to carry on campus. I'm hopeful that next week we can maybe talk with one of the folks down there in Lee County. I would love to know what specific training they're going to be getting. They've talked with the folks at Faster in Ohio, which, honestly, that part of Virginia is not that far from Ohio. You just head straight north, and you're going to run into it there in a couple of hours. So we will have more on this story. But this is big news for the state of Virginia, certainly being the first county in the state to adopt this. you know, look, you've got, besides the hillbillies up there in Loudoun County, Cameron, there are some urban and a lot of suburban counties, but there are also a ton of rural counties in Virginia.
Yes.
Outside of the D.C.-Richmond corridor. And now that Lee County has busted the barn door open, I think there are going to be a lot of other counties considering this.
The barn door, I mean, Loudoun County was the inspiration for Hee-Haw, as I remember. So interesting that you say barn door.
You know, it's funny. There is some dispute, yes, because I'm going down to Bristol this weekend. And when you're in Bristol, there is the Birthplace of Country Music Museum. Because not far from Bristol, well, in Bristol in like 1926 or 1927, there were these guys from a record studio in New York who came down to Bristol and they set up shop in a building. They started recording all of the people who would come out of the hills and hollers with their music. And from a place that's now called the Carter Family Fold, you had the Carter Trio that came down and got recorded. And that was really the birth of country music. Or so we are told. Because that's what those Bristolites want you to think. But up in Loudoun County, Cameron, little known fact, 1922, Ebenezer Buck Weaver showed up with his recording machine, and as it turned out, they just played really crappy music in Loudoun County. So they were playing country music at the time. It just wasn't as good as what it was down south.
Understood, yeah. Understood. The more you know.
By the way, that was as fake as the average Jim Costa report on CNN. So don't actually go repeating that anywhere. Okay? No, I heard Ebenezer Weaver went to Loudoun County and he came out. And he was going to try to record Waldo Emerson and his Leesburg Boys, but as it turns out, they just weren't very good. They were all out of tune, and no, none of that happened. None of it. Except for the stuff in Bristol. That part actually did happen. All right, coming up next hour, Frank Miniter of America's First Freedom going to join us on the program. Also with Scott Bach, head of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs. He'll be with us later on in the hour as well. More school news out of Colorado. There are a couple of students who are getting involved at the University of Colorado Boulder in the fight over Boulder, Colorado's new gun ban. Because remember, nobody wants to take your guns. Except for the people who are actually trying to ban and take your guns. In Boulder, for now, you'll be allowed to keep them as long as you register them with the police. In Deerfield, Illinois, if they get their way, you just can't keep them. You have to get rid of them entirely. The College Fix reports that one of the lead plaintiffs to overturn the Boulder gun ban, 20-year-old Tyler Fay, who is a college student there at CU in Boulder, also a member of the CU Boulder Shooting Sports Club. He joined the lawsuit because in addition to banning semi-automatic firearms there in Boulder, the law also forbids selling a firearm, any firearm, any long guns included, to those under the age of 21. Tyler's 20. He says Boulder is clearly discriminating against students who live within city limits and is preventing us from exercising our constitutionally protected rights. Well, he's not wrong. He said, by focusing on age instead of criminals, Boulder's preventing law-abiding college students like myself from defending themselves in their homes. He says, it was important to me to stand up for all the young adults in Boulder and represent to the country just how wrong this is. Barrett Barker, who is a junior at CU Boulder, a conservative activist, as described by the College Fix, said the students most affected by this ordinance are the ones on the shooting team, members of gun clubs, and any student who is a legal firearm owner within these city limits. He says it's not just those students, though, who are having their rights taken away, but all students, which is an important thing to note. You may not be exercising your Second Amendment rights. That doesn't mean that you don't possess them. It doesn't mean that you should so easily discard them. It doesn't mean they're not worth fighting for. You may not be exercising your Second Amendment rights today, but are you really sure? Are you absolutely convinced that there will never be a time in your life where you might want to exercise that right to keep and bear arms? Maybe you just can't envision it. But I think it's kind of short-sighted to go ahead and scrap a right just because at the moment you're not exercising it. I mean, I haven't had anybody show up from the military to come sleep in my house. I'm not currently exercising my Third Amendment right to prevent troops from being quartered in my home. But I'm okay with it staying on the books. I'm not going to be launching any sort of repeal the third attempt anytime soon. All right, we've got to take a break here. But next hour, Frank Miniter talking about the election of Brett Kavanaugh. He says he brings clear reasoning to Second Amendment decisions, which is why gun control advocates are freaking out. Also, Scott Bach with the latest from Trenton, New Jersey, where, again, they're still dealing with this mag ban. You got more gun control laws introduced in the assembly all the time. It is a mess in the Garden State, but we'll get the latest from Scott coming up next hour. Stick around. Much more Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady. It's coming up right after this. With Kevin Dixie from No Other Choice Firearms Training. Kevin, how are you, sir?
I'm fine, Cam. How are you?
I am excellent. So tell me about No Other Choice Firearms Training.
The philosophy behind the training company is this. No Other Choice is just that. So we go out, we want to train people, get them protecting themselves, understanding what the Second Amendment is. However, before you ever use that skill set, no matter what you learn in class, you ever use anything, whether it be a bat, gun, car, against anybody else, you should be at a point of no other choice. You tried to run from the situation, talk your way out of the situation, avoid it altogether and never be there before you ever think about impacting a human life, even if they so quote-unquote deserve it, make sure you're at a point of no other choice.
You know, and it's I'm glad that you're emphasizing that, because one of, I think, the misconceptions that we have about concealed carry holders, about gun owners in general, is that we're all a bunch of trigger-happy nuts, right? Who're just looking for an excuse to whip out our gun, when that is the farthest thing from the truth. I mean, if we're ever in a position where you have to defend your life, I don't know about you, Kevin, I never want to be in that position where I have to defend my life.
Right. I've been carrying a gun almost 20 years now, and I've never had to deploy that gun. Now, I've had to deploy it in my form of work before, as far as a defensive tool to do my job, but I've never had to actually discharge a firearm against another human being, because they've always made the smart option of, hey, okay, this is going too far, let's stop. So I disagree with that. I mean, how many people are carrying guns today? And nobody's getting hurt, right? I think concealed carriers are some of the best people walking the face of the earth, because they have godlike power, and they respect it more than anything else. So it's totally false.
So how did you get into gun ownership? How did you get into firearms training?
I was working at the St. Louis City Police Department. I worked in the jail division, and I saw a lot of individuals that were making, good people making bad choices. Well, along with that job came a lot of firearms exposure and training and things like that. So I decided to kind of blend two things. I took the training opportunities, got into guns, started understanding my rights a lot more at the age of 21, and then I also wanted to train people not only to defend themselves against the guys I was working with every day, but also help people that were just making bad decisions to make better decisions, you know, so they're not in situations. So that went to training. Let's teach you how to defend yourself and be safe against some of the evil people in the world, but let's also prevent you from becoming a person that's a good person but making mistakes, and let's blend the two. And that's how it started.
You know, in St. Louis itself, where you're based, right, and you look at Chicago, you look at St. Louis, you look even places like New York City or Washington, D.C., Baltimore. You got a lot of violent crime, but you don't have, I think, a cultural or a political push towards responsible gun ownership. It's almost the other direction. They don't want anybody to be gun owners, as opposed to wanting to make sure that training is available for anybody who wants to become a legal gun owner.
Correct. And the reason for that is because guns are polarizing, right? It's a polarizing subject, and a lot of people want to work on the emotion of the community. They want, you know, if you walk outside every day and your situation isn't the best, cosmetically your area isn't the best, it's easy for me to play on your emotions, right? And tell you that, hey, these guys are bad. Trust me. Let me defend you. And what I'm trying to tell people is, let's get you out. Let's show you what life is. Let's help you out with resources. Once you understand what you're working for, please understand that there is somebody walking this earth that will take that from you in a blink of an eye. So instead of trying to depower you to trust me, I want to empower you for you can protect everything you work hard for. And so whether it's in your current situation or you just want to work hard to get out of your situation, you need to understand you have to have the power to protect yourself, regardless of what somebody politically is trying to drive you to understand, take your own responsibility. It's safe, it's fun, it's the ultimate equalizer, and everybody that does it has a level of respect that is ungodly, and you need to understand that and just take it upon yourself.
So 10 seconds or less, Kevin, who is showing up for your training sessions these days?
Everybody. I teach and train everybody, but I have seen a great big push in women, and I love it, women, and I'm getting a lot more anti-gunners in, so it's always fun for me.
How about that? Kevin Dixie, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. If folks want more information, where can they get it?
You can look on Facebook at NOC for No Other Choice Firearms Training. You can also look me up, Kevin Dixie, D-I-X-I-E. That's on Facebook, and on Instagram it's at NOC Firearms Training, all one word.
Kevin Dixie with No Other Choice Firearms Training here on Cam and Company.
watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour two. Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, starts right now. Cam Edwards, your host. Scott Bach from the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Club joining us on the program. Member of the NRA's Board of Directors as well. Also, Frank Miniter from America's First Freedom. An hour from now, we have today's hero of the day. We have our deal of the day. We have our good guy of the day. I tell you what, we've got an update for you on a good guy that I think we had this story. I guess this was last week. This was out of Douglas County, Colorado, and it was a crazy story. We didn't know all the details, but basically some guy drove up into the mountains, into this campsite, started shooting at people, was stopped by a guy with a rifle, and that's basically all that we knew. He had been involved, this guy, in some previous crimes, but we didn't really have much information. So Channel 9 in Denver, KUSA, actually now has the full story, and it's a good one. It was a retired police officer from Alabama who was actually the person who shot that guy who was on a multi-county crime spree. This according to an arrest affidavit obtained by KUSA. The suspect identified as Austin Benson is now facing six attempted first-degree murder charges, as well as one charge of attempted aggravated robbery. KUSA reports before last week's incident, the 29-year-old did not have a previous history, a previous criminal history in Colorado outside of an arrest a decade ago for obstructing a Denver police officer and possessing drug paraphernalia. His alleged crime spree ended the afternoon of July the 2nd at a campsite. According to the affidavit, the retired officer told police that he'd been camping with his wife when he heard a man yelling. The retired officer said when he went to speak with the guy identified as Benson, the man told him to, quote, get him water and that the law was after him. According to the affidavit, Benson had a rifle in his left hand and was pointing it at the retired officer. The affidavit says the retired officer then went into his camper and he gave his wife a handgun and he told her to take cover. By the way, Cameron, quick point of reference. Does that count as mansplaining?
Oh, man. You're reading it, so yes.
Well, I mean, no, the act of telling your wife, here's a gun, go take it to cover. If we could get an expert ruling,
yes,
from the Brady campaign, perhaps.
Well, mansplaining is any time a conservative man tells a liberal woman what to do. Beyond that, that's the definition. It doesn't go the other way around.
Just because I didn't tell anybody what to do, and I was accused of mansplaining.
I don't know. Dumb's the rules, Cam. I don't make them.
I don't understand the rules. Oh, anyway, that's probably the point. Okay, so I'm not sure if it's mansplaining to give a gun to your wife when there's a guy with a gun outside and say, take cover. I don't know. I'd go ahead and risk it if you're ever in that situation. Risk the faux pas, all right? Risk the possible shaming by a gun control group afterwards of, you know, he didn't have to tell her that. She would have known by herself. Anyway, after handing the handgun to his wife, telling the woman that he loves and wants to protect to take cover and shelter, he then took an AR-15 out of the camper and he went outside. He ordered Benson to drop the gun. Benson, however, started to drive away and then began shooting at the officer and his camper. That prompted the officer to return fire. According to the affidavit, Benson crashed into a tree. When the officer thought that he had fired all of the ammunition in his AR-15, he told deputies he set it in the bed of his truck and took out a second AR-15. I don't know if he just didn't have any extra magazines. I don't know. But he took out a second AR-15. According to the affidavit, the retired officer told deputies that he fired one more shot to see if Benson would react since he didn't see any movement in the car. Manitou Springs police officers arrived shortly thereafter, like seconds later, to begin their investigation. Benson had been shot in the arm and in the face. Nine News says it was the culmination of a tense incident that began with a carjacking call a short time earlier. According to the affidavit, Benson's vehicle was headed north towards the Douglas County, Colorado line. Along the way, he was shooting at other vehicles with a pistol. He hit multiple tires, but thankfully nobody was injured, according to the affidavit. One of the victims was a man who had been camping in the area with his wife and grandchildren. That victim told police that Benson had been parked in the middle of the road at one point and that his side rear tire was blown out. Benson's side rear tire. When the family drove by, the witness told police that Benson fired one round at him. They all ducked, and again, the tire was hit. The vehicle that Benson was driving had initially been referred to as stolen, 9 News says, but deputies said later he had permission to drive it. It's unclear, they say, still what prompted this crime spree to begin with. But now, again, we know a little bit more about what ended it and who ended it. A retired police officer from Alabama, camping in Colorado with his wife, who thankfully had several firearms with him, and so everybody was able to be protected. The suspect taken into custody, and the armed citizens safe and sound. There you go. So we'll try to keep our eyes on this, and if we get any more information when this case, you know, goes to trial, we'll hopefully be able to give you more updates on that particular armed citizen story. We have another one coming up for you, though, top of hour three, and it, too, is a doozy. Meanwhile, out in California this weekend, they're getting ready for the Crossroads of the West gun show in Del Mar, California. And according to the San Diego Union-Tribune, a steadfast group of gun show opponents say they will be there to protest. Phil Deal of the San Diego Union-Tribune says once again they will be vastly outnumbered by firearms enthusiasts. Thousands of people, he writes, will walk or drive past them and pay $16 each to see and handle all kinds of rifles, shotguns, handguns, tactical knives, and camouflage hunting gear. Ammunition will be sold by the case. It'll be the first gun show, Deal writes, at the state-owned fairgrounds since questions were raised in May about the legality of the event, because two of the family-run business officers are convicted felons. Members of the group's Never Again California, which is leading the protests, say that these shows should be shut down. Now the State Department of Justice is investigating to determine if any laws had been broken. The Elder Templeton said in May that the shows are legal because they're run by his daughter, Tracy Alcott, that he and his son are not involved in the show's management. According to the Fairgrounds General Manager, Tim Fennell, yes, Tracy Alcott has the approval of the Justice Department, holds the certificate of eligibility required to sign the gun show contracts. He said our board is satisfied with that. The show is being run legally. The gun control groups that are going to be targeting the Del Mar gun show say the show, quote, normalizes a culture of recreational firearms and promotes them in a country that has more guns than residents. Okay, so let's delve into that if we can for a second. So there are going to be folks who are going to give up a beautiful weekend afternoon to go stand outside of a gun show with signs, as is their right as Americans to do so, and protest those who are going inside, as is their right to do so. And the folks that are going to be standing outside on that beautiful weekend afternoon there in Del Mar, holding their signs, trying to shame those who go in, say the reason why they're doing that is because this gun show, quote, normalizes a culture of recreational firearms and promotes them in a country that has more guns than residents. Okay, well, if we live in a country that has more guns than residents, what do you think happens if you denormalize responsible, lawful gun ownership? You don't get rid of the guns. I mean, you might think that magically happens, but you don't. You've denormalized gun ownership, and you haven't actually gotten rid of the guns. So you still have a lot of guns out there, and a lot of people say, oh, no, this is absolutely abnormal to own guns, but haven't actually done anything to improve gun safety. Guarantee you there's still going to be tens of millions of Americans who say, nah, it's absolutely normal to own a firearm for self-defense. And the criminals out there are certainly not going to be persuaded by your shame campaign, because they're not persuaded right now by California's gun control laws. San Diego Union Tribune says firearms are sold at the shows, but California laws require a background check and a 10-day waiting period for the delivery of most guns. All gun sales actually have to go through a 10-day waiting period. So you may start that transaction there at the gun show. You won't finish it at the gun show. You'll have to go find that vendor or that dealer that you're working with, and you'll have to go to their brick-and-mortar shop, and you'll have to go pick up that firearm a week and a half later. According to the San Diego Union-Tribune, Residents of a few other California communities are also trying to end the gun shows there in the state of California. Members of the San Francisco chapter of the Brady Campaign to End Gun Violence went to the Cow Palace Fair Board in June to ask for the end of gun shows there. Chapter member Ruth Borenstein says they've indicated that they will likely put this on the agenda sometime in the fall. They listened politely and seemed interested but didn't say anything. There are also state lawmakers in Sacramento. Because the Cow Palace is actually a state-owned facility, there are lawmakers there in Sacramento who are trying to pass statewide legislation that would ban gun shows there at the Cow Palace. The Orange County Fair Board, the San Diego Union Tribune, says delayed approval of some Crossroads of the West contracts back in May, but in June they approved contracts for the shows in August, October, and November. Several San Diego County cities, including Del Mar, Solana Beach, and Encinitas, have approved resolutions asking the Fair Board to end the gun shows, but gun show supporters have outnumbered opponents at most Fair Board meetings, which is worth noting. You know, we talk a lot about showing up on this program. I've talked a lot this week about all of those avenues that gun control activists are looking to gain a foothold. And basically, they view any public body, as an opportunity. If it's your local school board, if it's your county commission, if it's your fair board, these are all opportunities to go before these officials, to ask for a resolution in support of gun control, to ask them to cancel the contract for a gun show, to do something to demonstrate their fealty to the cause of quote-unquote gun safety. And when we show up, look, sometimes when we show up and we outnumber the gun owners, doesn't mean that they vote our way, or the gun control activists, doesn't mean that they vote our way. Again, there have been several of these fair boards that have looked out on a crowd that is dominated by gun owners and said, "Now we're still gonna vote against you." But that doesn't always happen. There have been also counties, particularly in Northern California, where gun control activists have tried to shut down the gun shows held at county fairgrounds. And they've been met with quite a bit of opposition, and those plans have not gone forward. San Diego Union Tribune says that they do quote the Assemblymember Todd Gloria, who introduced a bill in the legislature in March that would, quote, strengthen the restrictions on concealed carry permits. Because, again, in California, right, I remember self-defense isn't necessarily seen as a valid reason to obtain a concealed carry permit. So it's already in a lot of the population centers nearly impossible to obtain a concealed carry permit. But this guy wants to make it even harder. So far, though, he has not taken up the issue of gun shows. Roseanne Sharp, a Del Mar resident and leader of the area's Never Again movement, said the group and its supporters plan to bring three murals to the weekend's protest, the largest measuring 10 feet by 4 feet, with the theme, quote, "Show You Care, End the Gun Show," will be on display Saturday. Now, again, let's think about that for a second. Show You Care, End the Gun Show. Show You Care about what? About violent crime, about stopping violent crime, particularly crime in which a firearm is used. Show that you care about doing that. And how do you show that you care about stopping violent crime where a gun is used? You end a gun show where every gun that's sold goes through a background check, and there's a 10-day waiting period, so nobody actually walks out with a firearm if they walk into that gun show hoping to buy one. That's what you've got to end. You've got to end the legal sale of firearms if you care about stopping gun violence. That's the takeaway. And if that's what you believe, then first of all, I disagree with you, but that's not a quote unquote gun safety message. That's an anti-gun message. That's saying that in order for us to, again, have a safe society or a safer society, we can't have legal gun sales. Now, here's the thing. I suppose the gun control advocates would say, well, look, even if we wanted to ban all gun sales going forward, which, by the way, they're not going to be able to do, but even if that's what they say, okay, we just want to end all gun sales going forward, we're still not talking about taking anybody's guns away. And, yeah, they actually still are. Again, in Deerfield, Illinois, that's exactly what they're talking about doing. In California, they're not talking about taking people's guns away. They're definitely talking about taking people's magazines away because they passed a law that takes people's magazines away. If you're a gun owner in California who has legally owned a magazine larger than 10 rounds, go back to the late 1990s, you've had that magazine in your possession. The state of California has told you, you can't anymore. You cannot keep that magazine. You got to do something with it. You got to turn it in. Got to take it out of state. Got to destroy it. The only reason why gun owners are not currently under an edict to comply with that law is because a federal judge stepped in and said, well, you know, based on the merits of this case, what I've heard so far, I'm not sure the state's likely to prevail here. I think these gun owners have a pretty strong case that their Second Amendment rights are being violated, so I'm going to put a hold on the enforcement of this law while it's being litigated in court. But, you know, again, scratch that veneer of quote-unquote gun safety, the rebranding effort that the gun control groups are using right now. All you got to do is scratch the surface a little bit, and it's really easy to see. That is just a new coat of paint on a tired old ideology that comes down to, we got to ban guns. We got to make it impossible for people to legally own them. And we have to go after the culture of responsible gun ownership in order to cut down on the criminal misuse of firearms. I don't get it. I'll be honest with you. But apparently I'm not the target audience. All right, when we come back after a quick break, Frank Miniter joins us. We're going to talk about Brett Kavanaugh. Nominated by President Trump to the Supreme Court. Frank says he brings clear reasoning to Second Amendment decisions, and that is why gun control advocates are flipping out. Stick around. We've got more Cam and Company coming up right after this.
Everyone understands the importance of securing our public places. That's why every major corporate campus and office tower, every sporting event, celebrity award show, and government building, all of it is protected by multiple layers of security. But when it comes to our most precious resource, not gold or oil or precious jewels, our children, we utterly fail to protect them at school every single day. Each day that goes by, our banks and businesses are better protected than our children. That's a national outrage. NRA's School Shield program has already made world-class security resources available to hundreds of American schools. It's free of politics, and it's free of charge. If your child's school isn't protected, ask them to call School Shield today. We're the National Rifle Association of America, guardians of our school children and freedom's safest place.
It's as patriotic as it gets. A gathering in the heartland of folks from all 50 states. Welders, salesmen, farmers, accountants, soldiers, first responders. Here, we're all the same. Here, we are all race fans. We are proud of our country, proud of our military, proud of our drivers. We proudly stand for our national anthem, and we have a great reverence for names like Yarborough, Earnhardt, Waltrip, and Gordon. Yes, there are other NASCAR races, but this one is special. 500 temper flaring, finger waving, ego busting 15 second laps. And deep into the warm August night, hardly a seat in the last great Coliseum will be used. You see, this isn't just a race. This is America's night race.
We're talking with Mike Kalos of the United Sportsman's Youth Foundation. Mike, how are you, sir?
Pretty good. How about you guys?
I am fantastic. What can you tell us about the Youth Foundation? What's the mission statement?
The mission statement is to teach kids about conservation, get them out of the house, basically, come out with us. We teach them how to fish, hunt. We take them hunting, raise all the money to take them on little events like that. We do river cleans with them, clean up the rivers, a lot of trash in them. We do that every year. And that's about it.
Are you a nationwide organization? Are you regional? Where do you operate?
we operate out of a couple different states right now, but we're trying to hit all the states. Right now we're in North Dakota, Louisiana, Illinois, Iowa. We got some chapter members that moved to Arizona, so we're going to try and start one up there. And there's a couple other states, too. But we're trying to hit them all now, but we're just building right now.
So, I mean, it sounds like you've got room for people to get involved, either, you know, financially, making donations, obviously, but you need some boots on the ground around the country as well?
Absolutely. And they can visit our website. It's usyf.org, and that's how you can get in touch with us. Or they can come see us at SHOT Show.
Okay. What's, I mean, how long have you all been around, and what are you looking for in terms of volunteers and their background?
Oh, we're looking for outdoors people and for leaders or volunteers just to help us at events, you know, just to help us pick stuff up, set up. We need planners. We need writers. Photographers, we need, you know, we can use them all.
Yeah, sounds like every little bit helps at this point, right?
Absolutely.
And can you talk about the impact that this has on kids?
The main thing it has on kids, it gets them off that couch and gets them away from the TV. And it also teaches them a lot of responsibility when they got to go help us clean the river. And I mean, they don't have to, but they do help.
But they
us.
Should, they right? Should. All right, usyf.org.
Welcome back. It is Cam and Company. Cam Edwards, your host, at Cam Edwards on Twitter. Coming up an hour from now, Jazz Shaw of Hot Air. We'll talk about what's going on in New York's 21st Congressional District, where you have a candidate caught on tape saying, I support a gun ban, but if I say that publicly, I won't win the election. And the local papers, for whatever reason, seem to really be going out of their way to avoid discussing this. Yeah, instead they're directing their outrage towards the Republican candidate for some reason, who didn't say one thing when she thought she wasn't being recorded and another thing in public. Anyway, we'll talk about it with Jazz about an hour from now. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from America's First Freedom, writing at Fox News. Mr. Frank Miniter is with us, at Frank Miniter on Twitter. Frank, good afternoon, sir.
Hey, Cam.
Hey, I appreciate you joining us on the program. And a great piece introducing folks to the legal reasonings of Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's nominee to replace Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court. You say that he does bring clear reasoning to Second Amendment decisions, which is one reason why gun control activists are freaking out. Brady campaign sending out a fundraising email featuring me today, talking about all the gun lobby. They love Brett Kavanaugh. That's why we've got to save SCOTUS. I think that was their hashtag, save SCOTUS. Why are they so freaked out, Frank? You know, is this a guarantee that that their quest to have gun control laws upheld by the court is doomed to failure?
Well, this will just maintain a 5-4 balance right now on the court with regard to this issue. So it actually, because Justice Kennedy did side with freedom with McDonald and Heller decision, so it actually doesn't change the makeup of the case at all when it comes to the court at all, when it comes to the Second Amendment. But what I found really interesting about reading his decisions, and there's so many of them, but just how clear his reasoning is and then how freaked out that has the anti-gun groups and politicians, because they just can't take that kind of clear reasoning. And I've even used it on a few of my friends here. I'm in New York State, and a lot of my friends happen to be on the left side of the spectrum, just the way it is. And I enjoy talking to them about politics, if they will. And a couple of them have asked me, well, okay, what do you think about Kavanaugh? And they've only heard CNN's take, the New York Times takes. They had a very warped point of view. And I said, well, okay, do you believe the Second Amendment is an individual right? Do you want to have that debate? He goes, no, I get it. It is. And I give in. It's an individual right. Well, then shouldn't a judge uphold what clearly the Constitution clearly says, the Bill of Rights clearly says, and that what a judge's job is? They shouldn't be a philosopher king on the court. They should be simply upholding our Constitution and our laws. Isn't that what they do? Well, you're right on that front too, Frank. You know, they're supposed to uphold the law and clearly interpret it and not write legislation from the bench. So then you agree with me, right? And every one of those conversations, they go, you got me, Frank. All right. I know I shouldn't talk to you about this stuff because it's that simple and that clear. And that's what Kavanaugh does nationally. That's why it's driving these people crazy. He clearly articulates it. You go and read his opinions, and he puts it so simple. Because the Heller decision said semi-automatic handguns are protected, well, then semi-automatic rifles shouldn't be treated any differently. Why should they be treated differently? Of course they're protected by the Second Amendment. It's that clear.
And you know, it's interesting, too, because you can – when you start reading Second Amendment opinions, whether it's the Heller decision, McDonald decision, or some of these lower court decisions, I mean, I'm not an attorney myself,
And you can get lost in the legalese. I mean, there are certainly some decisions where I'm kind of skimming. I don't need to read that footnote. And as you say, this decision, his dissent in the Heller 2 case, it makes for plain reading. And that portion that you quoted in this article for Fox, let me just quote this if I can. In Heller, the Supreme Court held that handguns, the vast majority of which today are semi-automatic, are constitutionally protected because they've not traditionally been banned and are in common use by law-abiding citizens. There's no meaningful or persuasive constitutional distinction between semi-automatic handguns and semi-automatic rifles. Semi-automatic rifles, like semi-automatic handguns, have not traditionally been banned and are in common use by law-abiding citizens for self-defense in the home, hunting, and other lawful uses. Moreover, semi-automatic handguns are used in connection with violent crimes far more than semi-automatic rifles are. It follows from Heller's protection of semi-automatic handguns that semi-automatic rifles are also constitutionally protected and that D.C.'s ban on them is unconstitutional. When you compare that to the majority opinion in this case, where the judges said, well, okay, so we're not going to look at this through strict scrutiny. We think that there's a compelling public safety interest for D.C. to ban these guns, and so therefore, basically, they can be banned. There's not actually a lot of reasoning that goes into that decision. It's more, how do we try to uphold this gun control law that we want to uphold? And in Brett Kavanaugh's opinion, he even says, look, there are some gun control laws that I might like. That's not the question. The question is whether or not they're allowed under the Constitution, whether they are allowed under Heller McDonald. And under Heller McDonald, these are not constitutionally protected laws.
Well, lying gets complicated, as any human being knows. And so you start to read those left-leaning opinions, and it gets pretty complicated and obtuse pretty fast as they try to formulate some kind of reasoning to prop themselves up and look smart and try to characterize this as being a right of militias and not individuals. And it all gets very silly very quickly. And the clearest writing, of course, is when you're just going to be honest about it, plainly honest. Let me take the facts. Let me delineate them and show you what they mean. And that's why Kavanaugh actually reminds me of reading Justice Scalia's decisions. They were often written very plainly with some real zingers in them. He put some great one-liners in that I haven't seen in Kavanaugh's work. But the clarity of thought and writing was just the same.
So you say that there have been a number of decisions that Brett Kavanaugh has written. I mean, obviously, he's been on the bench for more than a decade. This is obviously the biggest Second Amendment case. Were there other cases that you looked at, either dealing with the Second Amendment or not, Frank, where that same type of reasoning came through, or was this maybe sort of a one-off from Judge Kavanaugh?
No, he had other Second Amendment decisions, but this is the plainest, the most direct, and easiest people to just grasp, and it's the biggest because it has to do with the dissent in the Heller decision, as D.C., of course, has been plainly trying to get around that for the decade now since that decision occurred. So this one was the best example to grab. But no, as you read his writing on many different issues, he just finds a way, and a good journalist should be able to do this. So you don't see this too often in the big papers because they are, unfortunately, the Washington Post, New York Times, so on. They're often just pushing a certain political agenda, which is also a type of lying, not being honest. So you don't see that kind of clarity of writing. To look for that clarity of writing in journalism, I think today you have to look at the Wall Street Journal and a few other places that are really trying to be honest, at least on the op-ed page more often than not. So that kind of honesty, yeah, it comes through in his writing, not just on the Second Amendment, but on other issues. And other issues, I think, is where the left is more afraid of him. I think this is not changing the court's makeup right now on this issue. It's because Kennedy was a swing vote on other issues that has the left so anxious.
Talking again with Frank Miniter of Fox News and America's First Freedom. You can read his piece at Fox News. And to that end, so let's talk about the anxiety of the gun control advocates here, because, you know, you said a couple of minutes ago, Frank, this doesn't really change the makeup of the court. Justice Kennedy was in the majority on Heller. He was in the majority McDonald. But we also know that the court hasn't heard a case since then. And I think one of the concerns for gun control advocates is, okay, was Kennedy the reason why we weren't hearing any more cases? Did it just get to the point where nobody really knew what Kennedy was going to do? And so the four anti-gun judges, they didn't want to vote to take a case because they didn't know if Kennedy was going to agree with him or not. And the four judges who, you know, decided in the majority in Heller McDonald, they didn't know what Kennedy was going to do. So, again, we don't know this, but I think that's one of the things that gun control advocates are freaking out about, because Brett Kavanaugh in Heller 2 did talk about things that haven't been heard by the court. He talked about a semi-auto ban. He talked about these sweeping gun registration laws that were put in place after Heller was struck down. I don't know that he was involved in any of the challenges dealing with the right to carry in Washington, D.C., but that obviously is another issue that the high court has not weighed in on directly. You write about how they did not take the Peruta case. So, you know, I don't want to there are good reasons, I think, why the gun control advocates are rightfully nervous about this. You know, we do know that, yes, he's not going to agree with, you know, Justice John Paul Stevens or Justice Ginsburg that, well, the Second Amendment is really only a right to join a militia. You know, and that's not, even if he agreed with that personally, sounds like his judicial philosophy would not allow him to rule that way in cases because the court has said differently in Heller and McDonald. So do you think that this appointment has the potential to break up that logjam that we've seen at the high court where for 8 years now the court hasn't heard a Second Amendment case?
Yeah, that's a great question because it only takes four justices to decide to take a case. It's not a majority decision. It's four out of the nine that make that decision. And we know that Thomas and Scalia, they were both public about this, voiced their opposition. Why didn't you take these other cases? It doesn't make sense to them at the time. But we don't know, at least I haven't seen anything public, where Kennedy was on this thing. So does this Kavanaugh, if he gets confirmed as a justice, does he change that makeup and become then a block of four that says, yes, let's take the next Peruta. Let's actually answer these big questions that are before the court, that the circuit courts are actually fighting about. Let's take one and answer one of these big questions. I think it's possible, but it's a roll of the dice. I don't know who that fourth person is that for some reason hasn't decided to go along with taking another case. My suspicion it's Roberts, just based on some of his other opinions and where he is, seems to be on things that he wouldn't want to take up this case right now. He doesn't seem to really like the big controversial cases. Even when he does take a big controversial case, he likes to downplay and just decide on as narrow a point of law as he possibly can, which is a conservative way of adjudicating, but that's what he does. It possibly does, and that's a very good point. That could be why they're so upset.
Well, again, we know that they're planning on spending a lot of time and money trying to derail this nomination. It's why I've been encouraging, you know, every gun owner out there, contact your U.S. senators, let them know where you stand on this. And again, if you're a gun owner, there's every reason to believe that just based on what Brett Kavanaugh has done in the past, that he recognizes the Second Amendment is an individual right. It's a real right. It's not a secondary right. It's not some sort of minor right, and it should not be treated as such.
And my two senators are hopeless. I've got Gillibrand, and I don't think it's going to happen in New York State. And I'd be one of these people who are going to back Kavanaugh for the Supreme Court.
Yeah, you know, Gillibrand, back when she was in the House, she probably would have written a press release praising the pick.
She was my congresswoman. She had an A rating from the NRA back then.
I know. It's amazing. When she was a congressperson, you're right. She was pro-gun, talking about the rifles that she kept under her bed, and then became the junior senator from New York, and all of a sudden, like on a dime, she found gun control. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, listen, Frank, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. Thank you so much for the writing, and I look forward to talking again very soon.
Anytime, Cam.
All right, Frank Miniter with us here on Cam and Company, at Frank Miniter on Twitter and frankminiter.com as well. Yeah, that was interesting when Kirsten Gillibrand became a U.S. senator, and like magically, I had guns under my bed? Really? I don't think I ever said that. I don't think I ever talked about keeping rifles under my bed. No, actually, here's the quote. Well, I don't do that anymore. We'll talk with Jazz Shaw coming up next hour about more New York politics. Scott Bott going to join us here in just a little bit as well. And, hey, here's a fun story for you from the website Surf Kentucky, which, Cameron, I mean, this is the best website ever. I want a T-shirt that says Surf Kentucky.
That'd be difficult, but good on them for trying.
Hopkins County, Kentucky. A former 20-year Hopkins County school board member has been sentenced now to 1 year home incarceration following his recent guilty plea in Hopkins Circuit Court, according to arrest records. 61-year-old Michael Morgan of Nebo, Kentucky, accused of carrying a gun on school property August 18th, about a month after resigning from the board for health reasons. School staff notified authorities after Morgan entered West Hopkins after school hours carrying a gun on his hip, which is prohibited on school property. Morgan actually had signed off on the gun ban ordinance during his tenure on the school board. Yes. So the guy who voted for the gun ban on school property, charged with violating the gun ban on school property. Apparently he thought maybe there was some sort of carve out, a guns for me but not for thee provision there in the law. Well, nope. Apparently not. He appeared in court for sentencing July the 2nd, pleading guilty to unlawful possession of a weapon on school property, will remain on supervised probation for 5 years in exchange for his plea that originally carried a maximum sentence of 3 years behind bars. According to probation orders, he's not allowed to go on school property or possess any weapons during his year of home incarceration. He is required to wear a leg monitor at his own expense. He can attend church, work, and go to doctor's visits. No word, by the way, and if the board is planning on revisiting that policy anytime soon. That is going to do it for this segment. We'll take a quick break. When we return, Scott Bach joins us talking about the latest in Trenton, New Jersey. News not just for New Jersey gun owners, by the way, but we know what happens in Trenton doesn't just stay there in the Garden State. They are exporting this all around the country, anywhere they think they can find a foothold. So stick around. We've got a report from the front lines in our fight for the Second Amendment right after this. I'm very pleased to actually get a chance to talk in person with Kyle Kashuv. Kyle, how are you, man?
It's good, man. It's good.
What made you decide that you wanted to speak out, even though you knew that what you were saying was going to be going against the narrative? And it's not, by the way, like you came out and said, hey, you know what, I think everybody needs to own every gun possible. What your message was, let's talk about things that actually work, things that we can all agree on. And I think that kind of got lost a little bit.
I mean, a lot of people like to straight up go and push policy that they don't really know about. What I've done is I've taken the time and I've looked at every single policy that I'm pushing out, and I've talked to senators and I've talked to people pushing the policy and creating the policy, and I said, look, there's an issue here, we have to fix that, but in total, I want to push policies that work. I don't want to push policy that ideologically sound good but don't do anything. As the president said yesterday, people like to push things that make them feel good, not actually impact the community and the nation positively. And I've been very careful in choosing what legislation I'm pushing and what I'm fighting for. It has to have more pros. The pros at the end of the day always have to outweigh the cons.
Yeah. You've had an opportunity to speak, as you say, to a lot of politicians, including the president.
Oh yeah.
I don't know how many senators you're up to now. And the interesting thing is, you're not only talking to people who you may agree with, you're talking to people who you probably disagree with too. You're not afraid to have those conversations.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's idiotic to kick out and not even talk to half of America. I mean, whether or not you disagree or agree with their policy, it's still, they represent millions of people and they make decisions. And if I can even on a sliver of change their opinion on a subject, why not do that? Why not think about the other side while trying to explain to my side? Like I talked to a senator and I explained to them the position of the Second Amendment, and whether he disagreed, he respected with my opinion, he understood some of the viewpoints, and whether or not he went to vote against or for the policy that I was pushing, I mean, I took the chance to meet with him. I'm going to take every shot and every opportunity I can. And I don't think that alienating half of America is going to be positive, because if you truly want to change, then you're going to look and you're going to try to talk to all of America.
Absolutely. What do you think of the walkouts in support of the Second Amendment that took place, just in late April?
I mean, since the beginning, I've been very headstrong about what I think. I don't think that walkouts do anything. I think it's for PR and publicity. And you can do that if you're going for PR and publicity, but if in reality you're trying to push policy and make sure that something that my school never happens again, then you go to legislators. You don't waste your time protesting to get views or clicks for mainstream media. You go talk to your politicians. You go talk to your state legislators. You do a town hall. Doing a walkout doesn't do anything. It creates confusion in your school system, and it doesn't do anything. Like, tell me what a walkout has accomplished. I have not seen a single thing that a walkout has truly accomplished. What I've seen is talking to legislators, either from the left or the right, is what gets things done.
Yeah. So are you hoping to take what you've done and tell other teenagers, give them advice, give them lessons on actually how to be politically effective?
Well, look, I don't think I'm a professional in any way, shape, or form in this.
I think you have to be, though, honestly.
I mean, I just think that you have to look at it rationally and be like, look, at the end of the day, senators are still people. They have logic, they have emotion, and they understand the situations and consequences of their actions. They understand what policy effects and the day-to-day struggles of people. I can tell you that every Republican senator I've talked to truly cares about this. 100%, they never want to see this ever happen again. And talking to them has shown me that they don't ever want this to happen again.
Talking again with Kyle Kashuv, and what happens next for you, Kyle? I mean, where do you want to go?
Yesterday I got on board with Charlie Kirk and The Turning Point. I'm the director for high school outreach, and I think it's amazing, and I really hope to empower students. I use the term empowering somewhat cliche, but I really hope to make Republicans feel safe and secure to speak out. And I've seen that even at my school, Republicans are scared to speak out, and they're silenced. And people have told me, oh, Kyle, after all this, I feel more comfortable talking about political positions.
That's good. That's good. You're making a difference.
To me, throughout all the hate, people have come up to me and said, yo, Kyle, thank you for what you're doing. I don't feel as, like, threatened or intimidated now because you've spoken up and you've taken all the weight. And I think that's great. I'm willing to take the weight if it allows one person to feel more comfortable.
Yeah. So I got to ask, how did you end up here at the NRA annual meeting?
Look, man, I mean, definitely the NRA, definitely the president speaking was like, now I have to go. Like, the VP and Trump speaking, you can't miss it out. Pence was absolutely amazing. The entire crowd was absolutely energetic, and the president did amazing as well.
Yeah. So are you going to be old enough to vote in November?
No, I'm going to be 17.
Okay. What is your message? I mean, obviously you've got a lot of gun control supporters who are out there trying to register people the day they turn 18. What is your message as the director of high school outreach now about the importance of these November elections if you're old enough to vote?
We have to win.
Welcome back to Cam and Company. Thank you for joining us today. Hopefully you are getting ready for a fantastic weekend. I'm going to be headed down to Bristol and the Bristol Motor Speedway getting ready for the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race, which is coming up August 18th. Don't forget, September 14th through the 16th in Richmond, Virginia as well, we have the NRA Carry Guard Expo. You can get your tickets and find out more information at NRACarryGuardExpo.com. Want to welcome right now Scott Bach, NRA board member, head of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs. Scott, how are you, sir?
Hey, Cam. Great to be back. And things are hopping in the Garden State.
Okay. What's going on here? Because it's sort of like supposed to be the quiet time of year, Scott. The lawmakers aren't really supposed to be doing much. They're all kind of shifting into campaign mode for the elections. What's going on in Trenton?
No, here's the big news is we just had a hearing in our challenge to New Jersey's magazine ban. We sought an injunction, meaning the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs was seeking an injunction, basically asking the court to put enforcement of the law on hold while the court figures out whether the law is constitutional or not. We had a hearing on that before a U.S. district judge in Trenton yesterday, Judge Peter Sheridan. And so the surprise that came from this, and you're not kidding about this not being quiet time, the summer vacations. There will be no summer vacation for our council. And the reason is the judge, there was an oral argument. Each side took their turn and made their case. But the surprise was that the judge said, well, you know, there were some facts that the judge wants to have a full-blown hearing on in August. And so, you know, along with all our papers and their papers, there are a few certifications or statements of fact that are peripherally relevant to the case. For example, they have experts saying that nobody needs more than 10 rounds. You know, they have tried to compile statistics saying that in the average shooting, it's, you know, 2.3 rounds are fired. So why does anybody need more than 10? And of course, our side has put in its own statistics from criminologist Kleck, Gary Kleck. And so the court basically said, well, you know, I see the, you know, there are facts on both sides. I want to bring those people in and I want to do a full blown hearing where we can, you know, evaluate their credibility and cross examine them and get to, you know, to poke around. So, you know, this is both good news and bad news. You know, the good news part of it, Cam, is that, you know, we'll have an opportunity to seriously rip their position to shreds and expose the vulnerabilities in the quote unquote facts that they like to present. You know, the part that's not as great is that, you know, it means, I mean, listen, gun owners have until December to comply with the new law. So there's 180 day compliance window that is ticking right now. You know, the bad part of this is, you know, we want to get the law put on hold or thrown out as soon as possible. So, you know, we were hoping to have that done by the end of July. The earliest that could happen now in a best case scenario is the end of August. So, you know, it's a little bit of a complication. This judge is a George W. Bush appointee. We don't know a whole lot about him, but, you know, here's the really interesting thing, Cam. We're sitting in an empty courtroom waiting for this hearing to begin yesterday. And all of a sudden, the room, like within a 10-minute period, it gets filled up with young men and women. And, you know, like at first I thought, oh, these must be, you know, law clerks who, you know, work for the antis. The next thing you know, this room is like practically packed. Turns out all the interns in the federal courthouse in Trenton, all of them ceased what they were doing to come attend this oral argument. It was of such interest within the courthouse.
Really?
So, yeah. It was pretty amazing. We're all looking at each other going, who are these people? And and one of us asked them, and they had, like, it was really pretty fascinating. I guess it was the hot argument of the week or something like that. And of course, you know, this lawsuit has been brought and is supported, you know, with great support from NRA and NRA-ILA, who we can't thank them enough for what they're doing and helping us do in New Jersey.
That is, I'm actually encouraged by that. I'm encouraged that the interns there recognize that this is an important case because, you know, for a long time, Scott, within law schools, the Second Amendment was sort of treated as an afterthought. It's been 10 years since Heller. And I think that there is maybe, you know, more note given to the Second Amendment, but I'm encouraged to see that some of those legal minds were paying interest to this case. And you know, you talk about the good news and the bad news of this. Let me ask you, because you know, I understand that the judge wants to hear from these experts about magazines and to get into, you know, the number of shots fired in defensive gun use. I'm a little concerned that that's maybe actually straying away from the biggest question in this case to get into the minutiae and to ask a judge to suddenly become a firearms expert as opposed to an expert in the law here. The state of New Jersey claims that these magazines are, quote, dangerous and unusual and are not protected by the Second Amendment. When, Scott, what we know is that in order for something to be unusual, under the definition given in Heller, this would have to be something that is not in common use by law-abiding Americans. Magazines over 10 rounds are absolutely in common use by law-abiding Americans, including law-abiding New Jerseyans, for a variety of lawful purposes.
Well, obviously we agree with that point, and we would have hoped that the court could have resolved the injunction request just on the law without having to evaluate facts. And, you know, I mean, our case has three grounds. One is the Second Amendment. The other is the takings. It's an unconstitutional taking. The third ground is equal protection. And so, you know, we would have thought on the Second Amendment ground, you don't really need to probe as to whether it's covered or not. Mm-hmm. I mean, magazines are clearly in common use, but, you know, frankly, the other side has controverted that. They put that into controversy and challenged it. And, you know, here's a court, you know, I mean, you could see the judge was basically struggling with what to do. He said to the other side, what's a court to do? You know, how is a court to decide this? And he basically said, look, you know, there are facts that are in there. I would like to have a chance to evaluate the credibility of the people giving us those facts. And have a chance to have a full hearing on it. Now, that could mean any one of a number of things. It could mean that he's already decided how he's gonna find in the case, but he wants to go out of his way to be thorough and leave no stone unturned. And that could actually cut either way. It may be that he truly, you know, is struggling with, you know, the interplay between the law, which is independent of the facts, and the facts themselves that are always raised in these kinds of cases by the other side. Time will tell, but, you know, right now our legal counsel is going to be diving in deep and getting ready for a week of hearings in mid-August.
All right.
And then further legal briefing by the end of August, and that's when we expect to get a ruling on the injunction motion. So it's, I don't mean to get technical, but you know, look, the bottom line is the court's struggling with this and wanted to hear more. And you don't get to argue with a court about something like that. So.
No, you don't. And honestly, I mean, I truly believe this, Scott, you know, for a week long, hearing here, I think if we can put the facts out there, if you got a fair minded judge, I think we're going to win on the arguments of this case. That's my non-lawyer prediction. here. But you said that that hearing's going to happen in August, and then you're expecting a decision at some point. There's going to be one more round of briefings afterwards, so you're expecting a decision sometime perhaps in or starting in early September. We don't know exactly when that would come down.
By end of summer is when we expect it. If the judge is, like, ready to go, then it could be, you know, by before Memorial Day. I'm sorry, before Labor Day.
Okay.
Before Labor Day, but, you know, the briefs will be due by the end of August. So,
and when does this law go into it? I mean, I know we're in that 180-day window, but when do gun owners in New Jersey right now have to dispose of or get rid of or no longer be in possession of their magazines over 10 rounds?
It's 180 days from June 13th, so it's you know, roughly mid-December. And listen, we are advising people right now, hold on to your magazines, don't destroy your property, don't modify your property yet. There is still time. You know, if we have a decision on this by the end of the summer, that still leaves several months to comply in any one of a number of ways. So the whole point of our injunction motion is that the clock's ticking, and before people lose the benefit or value of their property, the court ought to consider, like, put the whole thing on hold while you take your time and figure it out. The one silver lining of this is that at the end of the summer, any facts in dispute will be resolved, and the court will not only be able in a position to decide on the injunction, but ought to be in a position to make a decision on the whole case. So, you know, at that point, the legal and factual arguments will have been fully vetted. So, you know, we could be looking at this thing, the whole thing being overturned in September. That may be too optimistic, but it's certainly a possibility.
Talking again with our friend Scott Bach, head of the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs. Now, one other thing that you note, Scott, is that the national gun control groups are very much involved in this. They are pushing for this gun ban or this magazine ban. They have filed their court briefs as well. So, you know, you may have a messaging campaign right now of moderation. We're not actually in favor of gun control. We're just in favor of a few common sense gun safety laws. But what they're doing is pushing for, telling people these magazines you currently own, you'll be a criminal if you maintain possession of these magazines going forward. They say they don't want to take your guns away. Scott, they're actually right now trying to take your magazines away in New Jersey.
Listen, there's no doubt what their end game is. Nobody can credibly argue that this is about safety, okay? This is about demonizing gun ownership. It's about making gun ownership as difficult as possible, harassing gun owners, and trying to, in the words of the former justice of the Supreme Court, trying to repeal the Second Amendment. You know, if they do it wholesale or one brick at a time, that's their end game, and they can put all the spin on it they want. But bottom line is they're arguing against safety. Their proposals make people less safe. They say people with these magazines are a danger to everybody else, which is absurd. This is a battle royale we are having throughout the United States and I guess with the rest of the world. And we're going to fight that good fight and do our part in little old New Jersey. But it's part of a much larger puzzle, and you know, NRA and groups like ANJRPC are doing incredible work to fight back and defend freedom.
Well, listen, thank you again for everything that you're doing there, Scott, and to all of the gun owners in New Jersey who are volunteering their time, who are giving their money, who are fighting for their Second Amendment rights. We are standing with you, and we certainly appreciate you coming on the program today.
Thanks, Cam.
You bet. Scott Bach with us here from the Association of New Jersey Rifle and Pistol Clubs, member of the NRA's Board of Directors as well. And again, the NRA supporting that lawsuit there in New Jersey. We'll see what happens during this week of hearing. But, this is one of the arguments that the gun control activists are making right now, is that anything that they want to ban, they just say, well, that's dangerous and unusual. And the Supreme Court said you can ban stuff that's dangerous and unusual. This is actually the argument that goes hand in hand with the argument that Avery Gardner of the Brady campaign was making, the erroneous argument that the Supreme Court said, you know, it's guns that were in common use at the time back in 1791. No, that's not what the court said. But hand in hand with that, so they're trying to claim that the court says, well, stuff that was around in 1791, that's what's protected by the Second Amendment. Anything that wasn't around in 1791, that's dangerous and unusual. And they're not saying, well, handguns were around, there were pistols in 1791 and there are pistols today, so pistols can't be dangerous and unusual. No. Basically, you had a single shot muzzle loader pistol in 1791. That's what's protected by the Second Amendment. Sam Colt, revolvers, forget it. John Moses Browning, the 1911, no way, no how. The Founding Fathers could never have envisioned those semi-automatic firearms or those revolvers or those repeating rifles or those semi-automatic rifles. Their argument is the Second Amendment stops with muskets. Now, the Supreme Court, again, has already told them you're wrong. That's actually not how it works. They've told them multiple times, actually, you're wrong. But that's still what the gun control advocates are pushing. And you know what? Every now and then they find a judge or a panel of judges that says, we'll just pretend we didn't read what the Supreme Court actually wrote about this. I like your argument better. Stick around. Hour 3 of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady. It's coming up next.
Speaking with Mark Bayless with the Valor Clinic. The Valor Clinic Foundation is the official name. And Mark, thank you for being here. Tell us, what is Valor Clinic? What do you do?
Thank you for having me, sir. We help struggling vets, usually with the War to Peace readjustment. Very often that includes the emotional scars of war, or PTS, as it's generally referred. And we've built a program for when PTS results in homelessness. We have a facility in Northeast Pennsylvania, where we restored an old historic hotel and made it into a bed and breakfast for homeless veterans, and we run a program that has a very, very good success rates for a follow-on placement. And we've built a program to rebuild the life skills and focus in their life that the veterans need to help them manage the emotional scars of war and their day-to-day lives that has proven remarkably effective. We have about 330 veterans through that program now, and they were all still alive, and we are very proud of that
fact.
Wow. And we are currently working to get some unity effort among other groups doing similar work. And we think there needs to be a rally cry, like pink is for breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And the color we are trying to make the rally cry, we're in the process of making. Let me keep it on a positive tone. We're in the process of making the rally cry to bring the other veterans groups together, and all agencies that are helping with this problem. Is would be in the color match system, a color called Pantone 395, but we call the color Vet 22, and I'm wearing this tie and symbolism for that color today.
That's the color. Very
and,
nice.
We tried to tie it to when you had to figure out, okay, what color do you use? America's very familiar with tie a yellow ribbon, right? welcome home, the veterans.
Of course.
And but we wanted some we need some alarm to raise here too. The suicide rate at generally acknowledged as 22 a day. The number by study varies some. I've seen them as high as 28 estimates and as low as 20. But if you talk to veterans' families who have been fallen as casualties in the war at home, they argue that a lot of things aren't tracked. A lot of the veterans, when they take their own life, are doing it by intentional overdose. And then the statistic goes up. It was an overdose. It wasn't a suicide.
Right.
Or one vehicle accidents. And those go down as a motorcycle crash or a car crash.
Right. So.
And they don't go down as a suicide. So there are some that suggest the numbers are much higher. But even if you use 22 a day, we've lost about 6,000 troops to armed conflict since 9/11. And in a similar time, do the math. 365 times 22 times, it's an alarming number. I believe it's in excess of 130,000 now as we roll.
My.
And it is a tragic epidemic, and it needs to be corrected. And I believe if all the people working on this problem don't come together somehow to show some unity effort, this problem will not be fixed. And so we call for other organizations or even businesses, when they're doing their Veterans Day promotions and celebrations, to acknowledge veterans. Maybe they do a hat tip to the war at home, and maybe include some Pantone 395 in their color and in awareness for the veteran suicide problem. And we believe the veteran homeless problem largely comes from the PTS problem as well. But I will spare your audience too much detail on that.
Worthy of another interview. Speaking with Mark Bayless of the Valor Clinic Foundation. All right, Mark, before we run out of time, how do we get more information about the Valor Clinic Foundation?
You can follow us on Facebook, keyword Valor Clinic, or you can go to our website at www.valorclinic.org. And we appreciate your time, taking time to listen and hear our message, and thank you very much for your support.
Thank you for what you do, sir, and keep up the good work. Stay in touch. We love what you're doing. Thank you.
You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour three of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady, starts right now. Jazz Shaw of Hot Air on the program this hour. Julie Kelly with American Greatness closing things out. Right, what's going on with Tony Katz, Cameron? Is he just like loafing on a lake somewhere right now? Has he got a big head since he talked with Vice President Mike Pence on his show earlier this week?
Yeah, I forgot about that. Maybe that's it. He did say he's on vacation, but I like your Pence idea better.
I think Tony's just out there, you know, patting himself on the back. Can you believe? Just looking in the mirror, having a cigar. You're an amazing man. Yeah, you're just a beautiful boy. Yeah. Oh, look at you. You got the vice president. You talked to the vice president. You nailed that interview. That's his vacation. He just looks at himself in the mirror for a couple of hours every day. Anyway, hope that he has a great time not joining us on the program this afternoon. That's okay. We've got Julie Kelly with American Greatness. She's going to do a fantastic job. We also have our hero of the day. We have our deal of the day. We have our good guy coming up here momentarily, as well as more of the day's top Second Amendment news and information. Let's get to our hero of the day, our deal of the day, and our good guy. Hero of the day, we told you that update out of Colorado earlier from WINK, yes, winknews.com. North Naples, Florida. Customers at Jack's Bait Shop got the scare of their life when one man tried to wreak havoc outside of the restaurant. If it wasn't for a good Samaritan named Tom, who happened to be standing outside, an evening out could have turned into someone's worst nightmare. Tom said, "You wonder if this is ever going to happen to me." And it did. According to witnesses, what Tom did may have prevented a tragedy. Tom says, "I pulled into Jack's. I just walked in to grab a beer. I walked outside to sit down. There were a table of ladies to the right of me. Almost immediately, this black Lincoln pulls up with all dark windows. Did a hell of a burnout." And Tom says what happened next was a blur. He says a guy who deputies later identified and arrested as 55-year-old Keith Zavataro of Naples, Florida, drove back to the front of the building, stopped, and then slowly rolled down his window and then pointed what looked like a gun. Tom said, "I got behind the cement pillar, and I showed my pistol, and he took off out of there really quick." According to the arrest report, other people outside also saw the gun. Zavataro, who is a regular at Jack's Bait Shop, was kicked out of the bar for causing problems earlier that day. Investigators say Zavataro gave deputies a hard time when they tried to arrest him at his house, hitting and kicking them. Deputies say they could not find a gun in his car, but he will be facing charges of battery on a law enforcement officer. Tom says, "I just know it's a crazy world. You never figure it's going to happen to you. But it happened last night. Glad that Tom, a concealed carry holder there in the state of Florida, was in the right place at the right time and willing and able to do the right thing to help protect those lives. He is today's hero of the day. Our deal of the day from the TDTnews.com in Temple, Killeen, Texas. Temple Police Department. Yesterday, identifying two men, including one on probation for a manslaughter conviction this year, as suspects in a shooting case that stemmed from a Wednesday traffic stop. 23-year-old Frankie Nathaniel Boyd III and 24-year-old Duval Somerville arrested in this shooting, according to Officer Shawana Neely. Frankie Boyd had a third-degree felony hold and was charged with evading arrest or detention. Somerville had a third-degree felony hold as well. Boyd's bond was set, again, keep in mind, Boyd is out right now on probation for a manslaughter conviction earlier this year, and now he's charged in a shooting while he was out on probation for manslaughter, and his bond was set at $3,000. That's it.
And this is the Lone Star State of Texas. I mean, I hate to burst your bubble there. But our deals of the day, they don't just happen in deep blue states. They happen in every state of the union. Both men arrested by the Temple, Texas Police Department have a previous felony criminal convictions for which they were put on probation. Boyd, again, that conviction for manslaughter in Bell County. In February of this year, he was sentenced to 7 years in prison for manslaughter. That was changed to 7 years probation, according to the Texas Department of Public Safety criminal records. The original charge against him was from a December 22, 2016 arrest by the Killeen Police Department. He was initially charged with aggravated assault causing serious bodily injury, a second offense, after a jury found him guilty of manslaughter rather than murder in the death of his 52-year-old roommate, Randy Oliver. Boyd assaulted Oliver during an argument there in Killeen, Texas. When found, Oliver was unresponsive, had various injuries. Killeen Fire Department paramedics began CPR, took him to a local hospital, later moved to another hospital in critical condition, and he ended up dying on Christmas Eve. Again, convicted of manslaughter, sentenced to 7 years in prison. Somehow they got turned into 7 years probation this year. Meanwhile, his alleged accomplice, Mr. Somerville, has a record of criminal convictions, arrested on January 21st, 2014 by the Austin Police Department on a robbery charge, convicted on July 18th of 2014, and was sentenced to 8 years in prison for robbery. That, too, was later modified to shock probation. But here's the good news, Cameron. Somerville's probation was revoked on July 8th, 2016. So that was just 2 years ago. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison 2 years ago. So the good news is that Mr. Somerville actually wasn't on the street because he was, no, actually, I guess that's not how it works. He was somehow, despite that 3 year prison sentence. Go ahead. What was that? What were you going
to
say?
No, I'm just being sarcastic. How does it happen? And we know what happens.
Yeah.
You listen to the show every day.
Yep. There you go. So probation revoked 2 years ago, sentenced to 3 years in prison. Magically, he's not been charged with escape. So they must have let him out at some point from his 3 year prison sentence at some point over the last 2 years. Somerville also convicted of misdemeanor marijuana possession as well as the unlawful carrying of a weapon, both in December of 2014, for which he received 18 days. In the Bell County Jail. And there you go. Your double dose of a deal of the day from Temple, Killeen, Texas. Our good guy day, and our good guy, as always, brought to you by our friends at Odor Crusher, WDTN, in, I believe this is Dayton, Ohio, Clark County, Ohio, Springfield. Off-duty police officer noticed flames coming from a home. Officer Jason Byron of Springfield Police headed to his dad's home in the Crystal Lakes area. It was Wednesday night. He saw black smoke coming from a house on Dogwood Road. He said, my first thought is they've got a rolling barbecue. And then he said, I noticed the smoke was black. And then I looked closer and I could see visible flames coming from the back of the home. So he calls 911, expecting that they're going to tell him, yeah, thank you very much. We've got trucks on the way. But no, he was the first one to make that call. So when he called, there were no trucks on the way. They got rolling after he called 911. He decided to take immediate action. He said, while I was on the phone, I pounded on the door numerous times and I didn't get an answer. I told dispatch I was going to kick the door in. And so I did. He said he announced that he was a police officer when he made entry. Another passerby stopped to see if he could help but didn't stay. And then Byron saw a boy who appeared to be about 14 years of age come out of a bedroom where he appeared to have been sleeping. Boy had no idea that his home was going up in flames. Officer Byron says, I thought everyone was at work, so I wasn't surprised to see him as he was surprised to see me. Officer Byron able to escort that teenager out of the burning home. Byron said he kept pacing back and forth in the driveway. I think he was just really shocked and surprised. Yeah, probably a little freaked out at seeing his house burn up, too. WDTN says many accrediting Officer Byron's quick actions for saving the boy's life, but Byron says he was just doing his duty. He said, quote, I just happened to be at the right place at the right time, and it worked out. He said, honestly, anybody that's in the public safety profession, EMTs, firefighters, police officers, sheriff's deputies, anybody else that would have seen those flames would have done the exact same thing. And Officer Byron also credited the Bethel Township Fire Department for their quick response. He said he expected the house to be a total loss. Instead, he says it is still standing. So Officer Jason Byron of the Springfield, Ohio Police Department, who, yes, was in the right place at the right time, but was also willing and able to do the right thing. And Officer Byron can say, and he's probably right, that anybody in that profession would do the same thing. But not everybody would do what he did. And so we thank him for being one of the many, many good guys out there. And I'm telling you, Officer Byron, again, I don't pick out these stories where the good guy gets a little stinky. It just sort of happens that way. But I did remember, because I'm traveling again, and I think it was last Friday, I wanted to show you my odor crusher bag that I brought with me up to D.C., but I'd actually left it in my car. But look at this. This is my range bag, my little overnight bag. It's perfect size. In this pocket right here, you've got the odor crusher, actual, you know, the little gizmo that puts the ozone in the bag and cleans up all the stink. It's absolutely fantastic. I love that bag. It's my new favorite. All right. Still to come on the program, Jazz Shah of Hot Air will be with us. Also, Julie Kelly from American Greatness joining us later in the hour. And we have more of the day's top Second Amendment news and information, including a story from Delaware where gun control advocates are now accused of harassing Delaware gun rights activists. Yeah. Mitch Denham, who's the president of Delaware Gun Rights, said two of his members were harassed by a group of local gun control advocates who almost cost them their livelihoods and more. He said they were both members of Delaware Gun Rights. They both stood up in Legislative Hall, and they fought back against the laws that they were trying to pass this year, and now as retaliation, they went after these two gentlemen's livelihoods and possibly more. I said one of the members, a local school teacher, was approached by administration over a post that he had made on the Facebook page of Delaware Gun Rights. The gun control group, apparently, who reported the post to the school claimed that it was racist, at which time the administration ordered the teacher to remove it or face termination. Denham said there's a teacher at a local school. He was approached by the dean, and the school was stating that members of a left-wing organization locally had approached the school calling him a racist because he pointed out that one of the members that spoke in front of the legislature was an illegal immigrant of her own admission. They went after him for racism, Denham said. I went to his dean and said he's a racist. The funny thing is, Denham said he's multicultural, he's German, he's African-American, he's Caribbean. He was asked to take down his posting, the truth about what she is, and he was told that he would lose his job if he didn't. Meanwhile, a local firearms dealer, an FFL, who operates out of his home, has a business license, had his home raided after gun control advocates reported alleged illicit activity to law enforcement. This is from Delaware 105.9. Denham said, quote, a local gun store owner had a store raided because of them saying that he was doing illegal activities and got a legislator involved in that. And the store was raided by ATF and the state police. Denham said they found nothing wrong. Everything was done properly. He's done a very good job of record keeping, so they weren't able to find anything wrong with them. But the allegations were that this, again, was coming from gun control activists in Delaware. Delaware 105.9 says the alleged incidents come after two Democrats tipped the scales last month and voted against lifting the rules to bring a vote on legislation to ban, quote-unquote, assault weapons in Delaware, prompting cheers from hundreds of gun rights activists who were in attendance at Legislative Hall. The bill to ban, quote-unquote, assault weapons failed to make it out of committee, which many, Delaware 105.9 says, considered to be in part due to the overwhelming lobbying efforts of gun rights activists who showed up in droves at Legislative Hall all the way up until the vote to lift the rules. So if I'm reading Delaware 105.9 correctly, gun control advocates upset, apparently, by that vote that didn't go their way. Because remember, they had the governor stumping for this gun ban. That was the biggest legislative priority for gun control advocates in Delaware this session, this gun ban. And I thought that they had it. Again, they had the governor's backing. You have a Democrat-controlled legislature. He got this one in the bag. And we're going to apply some pressure. Maybe there are going to be some of those, quote-unquote, moderate Republicans that will cave. We've got this. And so they had their rally, and it was, you know, I mean, they got a few dozen people out there. But at all of these meetings across the state of Delaware where people are, lawmakers are talking about this gun ban, these gun control advocates, they are outnumbered 4, 5, 6, 8, 10 to 1 by gun owners. And not only are they showing up at these town hall meetings, they're contacting their lawmakers. And so this bill comes up in committee, and yeah, a Democrat crosses over. And so you had one Democrat and two Republicans vote against this gun ban. You had two Democrats vote for it. Bill dies in committee, or so we thought. But gun control advocates, they had one more parliamentary procedure that they could pursue, and they did. They, again, rallied the governor, had another big anti-gun rally on the steps of the Capitol. We're going to bring this bill straight to the floor. We deserve an up or down vote on this gun ban. Every lawmaker deserves the opportunity to say where they stand on this issue. And so they had a vote on the floor of the legislature to discharge that piece of legislation out of committee, to bring it directly to the floor of the Senate for a vote. And then you had two Democrats cross over and vote with every Republican not to bring the bill forward. And then the bill officially died. There were no more parliamentary procedures that the anti-gun advocates and the anti-gun lawmakers could pursue. The allegations, though, is that apparently after that, rather than, you know, try to talk to lawmakers, try to talk to those Democrats, even try to replace those Democrats with anti-gun politicians. The allegations are that the at least some gun control advocates there in Delaware decided to go after those engaged citizens who were active in this legislative session. And as I got to tell you, that's it's a disturbing story to see here. And, you know, we see these types of stories each and every day, but I'm not going to be, let's put it this way. I will eat this hat if this particular story about incivility in politics goes anywhere other than Delaware. I'm not even sure it's going to get reported in the Wilmington paper. But if this story goes national, I'll eat this hat. All right, when we come back here on Cam and Company, Jazz Shaw of Hot Air talking about a story that has gone at least kind of national. New York 21, Tedra Cobb, the Democrat running for office there, caught on tape telling gun control advocates, I support a gun ban, but if I say that publicly, I'll lose the election. So, mum's the word. Stick around. We've got more Cam and Company on the way right after this.
Speaking with Dirk Grove from NRA Store, I'm always excited to talk about, Dirk, what's new at NRA Store? What do you got for us today?
We've got a couple exciting items. One of the most important things that I wanted to talk about was, as you all know, there are some folks out there that have changed their cooler brands lately, and we have a really nice cooler from Orca. It's a 20-quart cooler. It's roto-molded with 2 inches of insulation, so it's supposed to keep ice cold for 10 days, which is
wow,
kind of amazing to me.
Yeah.
It's 20 quarts, so it's a manageable size, and it's a nice black, and it has a nice gold, huge NRA on the top of the cooler.
I heard a little something about that cooler thing, so it's great to see NRA stepping up and bringing a product like this forward. It's a beautiful-looking cooler, and it's perfect timing because, you know, it's getting to be that outdoor weather time out there, Dirk, all across the country, so that's awesome.
Exactly.
Yes.
And folks that are going to carry those coolers to the beach will want to wear our new T-shirt.
Ah, good segue,
it
Dirk,
says,
by the way. Very
says
well
says everything you need to say. It says, and I am the NRA. And it's red, white, and blue, and it comes in men's and ladies' sizes, so we're not going to leave anyone out, and it's must-wear for the summer.
Awesome. Now, Dirk, I need to ask you a point of personal preference. When they're men's sizes, they're good men's sizes. Like a guy of my size, I'm so frustrated when I get a shirt, I wear a 2X, and it doesn't fit me very well. I imagine these are good roomy shirts.
They're good and roomy, but, you know, we do offer 3X if you would like
there
to
you
avail yourself of that as well.
I'll take that in, Dirk. I'd rather the shirt be too big than too small. So that's awesome. The I Am the NRA shirt, perfect for the,
yep,
for summertime wearing.
And so, you know, we know that, that if you're going to be wearing that shirt, you might be supporting us politically, but there's a really good chance that you're also going to be a shooter. And so because of that, we have some things specifically for shooters.
Good.
One of the things we have is our new updated cleaning mats.
Ooh.
Our cleaning mats, we started out with cleaning mats a few years ago, and we sold just a boatload of them. We only offered AR-15 and 1911. Now, we've updated these with all new diagrams, and they are heavily researched diagrams, so I'm very confident in the accuracy. But we offer AR-15, we offer 1911, we offer Glock Generation 4, and we offer a Remington 870. And by the way, the 870 is long enough to actually place your 870 on it while you're cleaning it.
Awesome.
They're solvent proof, moisture proof. They'll keep your kitchen table nice and clean while you're cleaning your firearms.
Perfect. Speaking with Dirk Grove from NRA Store, what else you got, Dirk?
I got one more thing today. We've been working with the makers of Sport Ear. They make hearing protection. They've got some earbuds. They call them the Axel Ghost Strike. What's really cool about these things is they amplify sounds up to 6 times, but anytime they detect a noise that's higher than 85 decibels, then they automatically suppress and protect your ears.
Wow, that's cool. It's so great, Dirk. There's so much good high technology, and it's so important to protect your hearing when you're a shooter. So it's good to see the NRA store once again stepping up with a product like this for folks who are out there shooting. That's good stuff.
Well, we know our audience.
You think you figured it out by now, huh, Dirk Grove?
I think so, yeah. And by the way, the audience can always find us at, they can get a new catalog if they like, but it's 1-800-877-6007 or NRAstore.com.
There you go. How easy. I always look forward to getting my catalog in the mail, Dirk Grove. Love it. Love it when you're on the program. We appreciate it. NRA Store, check out all these great new products and all the other stuff from NRA Store. Thank you, Dirk Grove.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Welcome back. Cam and Company here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host. Julie Kelly of American Greatness joining us here in just a few minutes. Right now, I want to welcome to the program Jazz Shaw from Hot Air. Jazz, good afternoon, sir.
Cam, how are you?
I am excellent. Been covering the story out of the 21st District in New York all week long. This is fascinating to me. I'm so pleased that you've been writing about this. Now, where are you? Because you're a New Yorker. Where are you in relation to New York 21? Is this your district?
Not my home district. No,
okay.
My house where I reside is at the absolute opposite end of the state. Excuse me. I'm just getting over a cold. Down on the Pennsylvania border. Although we do have our camp that we go to every summer and I tweet about, which is in the 21st District, which is at the opposite end, up along the Canadian border and heading out towards Vermont. It's called the North Country, you know, just locally. And very sparsely populated. It's where the lakes are. It's up in the Adirondack Mountains.
Okay, so those beautiful pictures that were on your Twitter feed last week of your office right there on the lake,
yep.
That's in the 21st District.
That's all from deep in the heart of the 21st District, yes.
Okay. So you've got Tedra Cobb, the Democrat, who's running here. And a little bit about the 21st. This is a district that voted for Barack Obama twice, went for Donald Trump 54-40 in 2016. Elise Stefanik was elected in 2016, the youngest member of Congress. They get age 28. She's a Republican. And so this is a seat that Democrats are hoping that they can flip. I mean, if they want to take back the House, they've got to get these districts that, you know, may have been more purplish, right? And so they view this as a winnable district. Tedra Cobb is the Democrat running. She won a competitive primary with over 50% of the vote, has pledged honesty and integrity in her campaign, signed a no-lies pledge from the Post-Star paper, Jazz. And then this week, it comes out on tape. She's talking to gun control advocates about a conversation she had with a woman at a luncheon, and she said, this woman, you know, told me I support a quote-unquote assault weapons ban. How do you feel about assault rifles? And I said that they should be banned, but I can't say that. And she said, well, I want you to. And I said, I won't win. She went on to say, I said, Moms Demand Action says, and Trisha Plew from Moms Demand Action said, do not say that you want an assault rifle ban because you will not win.
So here you have, Jazz, a candidate caught on tape, her own words, saying, I believe something, but I can't let the voters know this because if they know this, I'll lose the election.
Yeah, also, I went over and checked on her website, and unless I missed it and somebody's free to correct me, she doesn't even mention Moms Demand Action on her website. I found no reference to that, but in candid conversation, she's not only aware of them, but she's in touch with them. She's getting support from they do make donations, but they're talking to her closely and helping to guide her with the language of what you can and can't say up in mountain country and still manage to get elected. Now, everything you said there is true. There was a big brouhaha because she was caught, you know, saying, you know, I told this lady, you know, I want a ban, but I know that I won't win if I say that. There was a bit of the story that I brushed over, and a lot of people did. When I saw she went and signed this loyalty honesty pledge, we're not going to, you know, tell any lies, not to the press, not to the public, not on social media, et cetera, et cetera. I went and rewound the tape a little bit, and before that incendiary quote that everybody, including yours truly, was focusing on, there was a bit of conversation prior to that with two of the teens that she was meeting with at that restaurant. And one of them was expressing his dismay over the fact that there are, quote, so many things you can't say. And then one of his compatriots on the – it's a group, by the way, known as Teens for Tendra, who have been offered their own private Facebook group so nobody can hear them chatting about these things, who said, well, I don't really care, but the good news is, you know, once you get elected and go there, she can vote with her heart. And this was said directly in response to the comment about a gun ban. And what do you think? Do you think this nice, honest Tendra jumped in and said, no, no, young men, we must be careful. What we say to the public is what we must do when we go to office. You think that's what she said, Kim?
Well, she signed the pledge, so that must have been what she said.
She did sign the pledge, yes. But instead, when the kid said, well, at least if we get her elected and she goes to Washington, she can vote with her heart. And all Tendra had to say was, right.
Right. Interesting. Now, as you point out in a statement to the Watertown Daily Times, Tedra Cobb said, quote, she's not trying to pass an assaultment ban because it would be impossible with the current Congress and president. So instead, she's focusing on gun control measures more people agree on, which, by the way, she still has not come out and said, yeah, you know what? I want a gun ban. I mean, like, to this day, this is now, I think, day three of this being a story in the 21st Congressional District, and she's talked about how she was honest with those kids. She's talked about how, again, it's a moot point, but she cannot say in public what she told those kids in private, Jazz.
No, she can't say it, but the question I would like to hear asked more than that is, well, okay, this is what you said. You're not working for a gun ban. You're working on things that are more acceptable. But if you were elected, if you took the Lee Stefanik seat and someone else proposed a gun ban, would you vote for it? That's the question I'm waiting to hear asked, because in private, she seems to have given every indication that she certainly would. Now that she's taken the, you know, truth pledge, I think it would be very interesting to have someone put that question to her and have her answer it, perhaps during the debates that are coming up before we go to general election.
The debates are going to be fire there in the 21st district. I will say I would expect Lee Stefanik to pose this question more so than the local media. I don't know if you've actually been following any of the coverage up there from papers in New York's 21st, but the Post Star, the very paper, Jazz, that had this no lie pledge, it's been fascinating. They've written two columns. They had an editorial yesterday. They have a column today. And they both are taking Lee Stefanik to task. There has not been one word written by the editors or the editorial board of the Post Star newspaper about the candidate who signed their no lies pledge not being honest with voters.
Yeah, the newspapers up there are not
really reflective of the general voting population in North Country. And my father-in-law lives in that district and has quite a few complaints about the papers up there. But that's really not different than in a lot of other parts of the country. They have not taken her to task. They instead decided to spend a tremendous amount of their time saying that it took Elise Stefanik too long to take the pledge. Well, the day they asked for it, a friend of mine, who works on her staff and is one of her surrogates, wrote back and said, obviously, you know, we're taking the pledge. And the paper that was doing the request said, well, we've got a new policy that we don't accept statements from surrogates, so we'd like the statement from the candidate. And it took them, I don't know, some ungodly amount of time, like 36 hours, to actually get Elise Stefanik back off the trail and have her go ahead and send something and call. And while she was delaying doing it, so I don't know when this became a new thing in the media where someone who is one of your campaign representatives can't go and give a statement on behalf of the candidate. But that's what they focused on. But she gave the exact same response that he did, saying, of course I'm taking the pledge, you know. And then they sort of grudgingly said, well, okay, well, then she did finally do that. You know, it was kind of embarrassing.
Yeah, it has been embarrassing. Well, again, I don't know what happens next here. The candidate herself seems very intent on just trying to, you know, ride out the news cycle. People will forget about this. But, you know, I want to ask you, I mean, as someone who spends time there every year, as you say, this is a sparsely populated part of the state of New York, but this is a place where there are a lot of hunters, there are a lot of outdoorsmen. This doesn't really seem to me like something that those gun owners up there in the 21st are going to forget between now and November, Jazz.
People in the rest of the state, including yours truly, travel to the 21st district to go hunting and fishing. And everyone up there hunts. I mean, there's a bar very close that I've gone to many times to the headquarters for the Post up there, where you walk in and it's just a line of deer and bear heads mounted along the wall. Yeah, this is not a place where anybody wants to talk about a gun ban, or you don't want to talk to the residents about a gun ban. That's not going to fly. I will say that the kids, if you listen to that entire video clip, they do make a point. The Democrats up there, or if you want to say the liberals up there, they are different by a great margin from the liberals you find on the coasts and the cities, things like that. People that register Democrat, at best, you would call them blue dog Democrats. You know, they are moderate at best. And the majority of the people who register Republican or they're independents leaning towards Republican have views that clearly would be mushy if you went down into Alabama or something like that. But that's an area that's as close as you get to hardcore conservative in New York State. There just aren't any places like Mississippi in New York State. But it is widely varying. I mean, it's a tough race to run for either party there. Elise Stefanik has, you know, she holds a number of positions that if you were in a more deep South conservative area, they would call her a rhino, certainly. But that's the kind of Republican you elect in New York, in upstate New York. So, and she's done really well there. She's quite young. She's done a couple of interviews with me for Hot Air, and just a great young woman who's doing a fantastic job. The economy's picking up. I think she's got a great shot at re-election, personally.
I'll be honest with you. I think she does as well. And I was wrong, by the way. She was elected at age 30, and it was not in 2016. I think she got elected, what, in 2014. Is that right, Jazz?
I think it was 2014, yeah. I didn't hear you say that. And, yeah, it was much younger than that, yeah. She is the youngest woman ever elected to Congress.
That's, again, that's impressive in and of itself. But, elected for the first time in 2014. And interesting to note, the Post Star newspaper did actually endorse her in 2016 by a vote of 3-2. Their editorial board voted to endorse Elise Stefanik back in 2016. I don't know if there have been some changes to the editorial board since then, Chaz, but I got to tell you, I said earlier, I'll eat my hat if the Post Star goes out and endorses Elise Stefanik this year. They seem to be playing their hand poorly right now and tipping their hand as well.
They are, and it really is not representative. I spend time up there, not just on my summer trips, but a little bit south of there. I have a lot. I grew up in the southern end of what is now that district, although I moved south later on. And, you know, it's, no, she's a good fit for that area, Elise Stefanik, and Kendra Cobb is, you can tell when she's talking to the kids. The other, before we go, the other interesting point is one of the teens for Kendra was actually trying to make the point of saying, well, you know, a lot of people of our generation are really not conservative the way, or are not liberal the way the rest of the country is liberal. Yeah, we would like to see something done about school shootings, but, you know, we don't really fall into that mold. And there's so many things where we're kind of caught out on this ledge. And it's true, even the younger people up there, I mean, they grew up in hunting culture. They grew up in a very self-sufficient culture that was devastated after the 2007 crash, you know, but people that still just, you know, find a way to make it on their own. And it's a unique place. It's a beautiful place. If anybody ever does get the chance to go visit the Adirondacks, I highly recommend it. Great people, great country, just God's country, and it's gorgeous.
I would love to make it up there. I'd love to see Lake Champlain and just visit that part of the country. I've been close, but I've never made it actually up the Hudson far enough and up into upstate New York. If I make it up there, Jazz, can I hire you as a guide?
Absolutely. We'll want to be a little careful. The day after I left camp this year, one of the larger they had ever seen black bears wandered into the camp. And there was a reliable report from one of the other property owners up there that this year, for the first time in living memory, they heard wolves. So they've been moving down from Canada. And, you know, we're kind of happy about that. And there's bald eagles up there. I mean, you would love it, man. It's gorgeous. Right across from our camp, about three-quarters of a mile away, there's a pine tree that I think has been there since Roosevelt was president. You know, nearly 100 feet tall, and there's a gigantic nest in the top of it, and there's a family of bald eagles up there raising babies.
Oh, man, that sounds awesome. All right, you're my Sherpa. When I get up there, not if, but when. Jazz, I got to go. Unfortunately, we got to take a break, but thank you so much, sir, for coming on the program. Thanks again for reporting on this, and glad that you had a great rest and a vacation, and glad that you're back to work.
Anytime. Thank you. I enjoyed it very much, and I'll talk to you next week.
All right, man. Jazz Shaw, join us here on Cam and Company on Twitter, at Jazz Shaw. Go back and scroll through Jazz's tweets when he was on vacation. It's absolutely gorgeous where he was. It was beautiful. Julie Kelly of American Greatness is going to be with us on the program here after a quick timeout. We'll talk about the indictments handed down today by the Justice Department against 12 Russians accused of hacking Democrats in the 2016 election. Well, the media is and is not reporting on this and what they're reporting that actually isn't in the indictments. We'll talk about all that with Julie Kelly right after a quick timeout. So stick around. Much more Cam and Company on the way.
Speaking with Cole McCullough about the NRA World Shooting Championship, Cole is the Competitive Shooting Division Director. And Cole, this one's near and dear to your heart because this is your baby, isn't it?
You better believe it is, and very proud of it. And there's a lot of great people that put it on, but we're going into our fifth year now.
Wow, it's amazing how quickly this thing has grown.
It is, and how fast we get old, right? So you got to take advantage of the good days while we have them.
So tell people, what is the NRA, the World Shooting Championship?
Well, the NRA World Shooting Championship is really the great end-all, be-all to competitive shooting that a lot of us view, meaning that we're going to provide all of the guns and all of the ammunition, all of the optics, and shooters are going to come in, and over a period of 3 to 4 days, they're going to have to shoot and conduct themselves across 12 different types of shooting disciplines, whether it's USPSA or three-gun or NRA precision pistol or long-range rifle or shotgun. You're going to have to perform all, and they equally count against you, and the winner is going to be the World Shooting Championship, the greatest shooter in the world.
Tell us about where it is and when it is.
It's September 20th to 22nd at the Peacemaker National Training Center in West Virginia.
And if you haven't been to Peacemaker, Cole, tell us about it.
It's great. We love it. Been there for many years, of course, those of you that know me. But certainly, Peacemaker has about 20 different ranges, is a huge complex, and is one of the largest places in the world, conducts basically as many shooting competitions as any place in the world.
And it's a beautiful drive out to get there, and it's a gorgeous facility. NRA World Shooting Championships, Cole McCullough, how do we get more information?
You can just go to your website and just search NRA World Shooting Championship, and there's a website. There's only about 20 spots remaining. The match is almost so full after about 2 weeks. So if you'd like to sign up or help the match in some way, you can register for that. But if you go online, you can check that out. It's also presented by Kimber, and there's about 40 different sponsors. So we're always very grateful to the sponsors as well. So
whether you compete or help out, you need to get out there and check it out.
Absolutely.
Cole, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I do know what it's like to be vulnerable. I know what it's like to feel like you can't protect your children or yourself. And it's terrifying when you have a spouse, whether it be husband or wife, that's serving overseas thousands of miles away. And you're the only one there to stand up for yourself, to stand up for your home, for your little kid that's right there next to you. I support the Second Amendment because of that. I support the NRA because they support my right to protect my kids. Everybody has a right to life, and you have the right to protect that. And nobody has the right to take it away from you.
It's as patriotic as it gets. A gathering in the heartland of folks from all 50 states. Welders, salesmen, farmers, accountants, soldiers, first responders. Here, we're all the same. Here, we are all race fans. We are proud of our country, proud of our military, proud of our drivers. We proudly stand for our national anthem. And we have a great reverence for names like Yarborough, Earnhardt, Waltrip, and Gordon. Yes, there are other NASCAR races, but this one is special. 500 temper flaring, finger waving, ego busting 15 second laps. And deep into the warm August night, hardly a seat in the last great Coliseum will be used. You see, this isn't just a race. This is America's night race.
Welcome back to Cam & Company, right here on NRA TV. Cam Edwards, your host. Glad that you've joined us today. And glad to have with us from American Greatness on Twitter at Julie_Kelly2. Julie Kelly is with us. Julie, how are you today?
How are you, Cam? Happy Friday.
Yes, happy Friday to you. Thank you again for joining us on the program. So you've got a piece at American Greatness right now, a quick take on the indictments handed down today by Rod Rosenstein, announcing federal charges against 12 Russian intelligence operatives for attempting to interfere in the 2016 presidential election. And as you write, this 11-count criminal indictment accuses several officials with a Russian military intelligence agency of conducting large-scale cyber operations to interfere with the 2016 presidential election. The computer systems for the DNC, Hillary Clinton's campaign, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee were allegedly hacked. Although you write, many victims gave up their passwords in a spear phishing scheme, and that information was then distributed onto the internet. Julie, I assume that our media has been covering the indictments here factually and somberly and not engaging in a lot of hyperbole and mindless speculation.
Of course. I mean, they always use the utmost care when it comes to anything related to the Russian election interference and how it could be tied to President Trump. But look, you know, here's what the media continues to miss that I raise in my quick blog post today. This is a scandal that occurred under the Obama administration. So all of this began, this indictment anyway, dates back to March of 2016. Well, who was president in March of 2016? That would be Barack Obama. And so this continued up until Election Day. Now, keep in mind, in February, there were also charges announced against three Russian entities and, I believe, 13 Russian individuals. for some social media, you know, chicanery, trying to target Trump voters. And that dated back to 2014. So as the media continues to bloviate and hyperventilate about Russian election interference to help Donald Trump, and that he, you know, somehow had a hand in it, the bottom line is this started back in 2014 under the Obama administration. We know from some reporting that they did receive warnings as early as 2014 about election cyber warfare attacking our election systems. It really did nothing about it. Now, Barack Obama did tell Putin in September to cut it out. And so I guess that kind of tough diplomatic talk really didn't do much. But that's what the media continues to overlook and ignore.
Well, listen, and to be fair, the reason why, Julie, is because the Obama administration, as they've told us repeatedly, was scandal-free. So this could not have been a scandal because they were scandal-free. Yeah. Now, look, and to be serious here, because, I mean, ultimately, as you say, what we're talking about is really serious. And this is something that we should not be looking at. I know we look at everything through the lens of Republican, Democrat. But as you say, this is something that we should actually be looking at. Quote, when we confront foreign interference in American elections, it's important for us to avoid thinking politically and instead to think patriotically as Americans here. And so thinking as Americans, one of the things that you do have to do is to go back and look at, okay, when this was taking place, what was happening? What were those safeguards in question or safeguards in place at the time? Because, you know, as you say, the talk from Obama was basically cut it out. But this was also, you know, at a time where a couple of years after President Obama had said he was going to have much more flexibility after he was reelected. He was going to be able to, you know, to work with Putin, deriding Mitt Romney famously for talking about the threat posed by Russia, our biggest geopolitical foe. You know, do you think that this previous administration, and again, there are a lot of unanswered questions, but were they caught flat-footed? Were they just not want to believe that Russia was capable of posing a threat? Did they not want to talk about the threat? Because, again, their narrative was, we're out here saving the world.
I mean, it's hard to point to one success that Barack Obama had over Vladimir Putin during his presidency. I mean, he acquiesced to him or, you know, made empty threats about him time and time again. And so, you know, this could just be another instance where the Obama foreign policy team and the president just had no idea how to counter this. But now look, and yes, I agree. You know, this is serious and it's something that should be addressed. And I know that Congress is looking into how to prevent, you know, any foreign agent from interfering in our free elections. And that's something that's very important that we protect that. It's nothing new. We do it to other countries. In fact, what's kind of interesting in the February Mueller indictments against the three Russian entities, they did not expect anyone to come forward and represent those entities. And there are American lawyers who are doing that. They actually asked Mueller's team for evidence, I believe dating back to 1980, of instances of when we have done the same to other countries interfering in their election process. So is it something really shady and something that we should be aware of and that we should try to use every technological defense to stop that from happening? Yes. Is it something new? No. Has it been completely overblown because somehow this is supposed to snare and taint the Trump presidency? Yes. And look, what was important in the indictment today and what Rod Rosenstein said in his press conference is that no American was involved in this. And there's no evidence that any votes were changed or swayed because of this happening. And so I think that, you know, that's important to underscore. And again, no evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government to interfere in the election. We are here, you know, 14 months after Mueller's appointment. We are 2 years into the counterintelligence probe at the FBI into the Trump campaign. There is yet to be one indictment that proves that the Trump campaign colluded with the Russians to influence the 2016 election.
And you're right about that. But, Julie, I mean, this is, again, what the press is doing. So this is a tweet from Christopher Ingram of The Washington Post. He says July 27th, 2016, Trump, Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. Indictment that evening, Russian operatives targeted Clinton campaign emails, quote, for the first time. Now, it's been pointed out. Let me just tell you, the tweet by Christopher Ingram right now has 6,593 retweets. It was pointed out by Andrew Prokop at Vox. So, you know, Vox, not a huge Trumpy news outlet, but even the Vox reporter pointing out this is false. This is incorrect / misleading. Right. The indictment says there were efforts to hack the Clinton campaign emails much earlier. So now you have a Washington Post reporter, though, Julie, that's putting this out there that makes it sound like, you know, Trump gives this speech, and then that night, you know, these Russian operatives just, you know, okay, we got the approval from the big guy, and they start going out when that's not what the indictment actually says.
It doesn't, and I've watched that video of Trump, his off-the-cuff comment. My point is, how do you hack emails that have been deleted? I mean, he was talking about her missing emails. How do you find those emails? Obviously, he was saying it as a joke. But what it goes back to is how this was set up and how Trump was even set up to answer that question. He was asked a question about that in the press conference. So then, of course, Trump being Trump, kind of unwittingly, or because, you know, that's just his style, comes up with this kind of, you know, quib about, well, find her emails. And he says, and I'm sure the press will reward you if you do. It wasn't anything that had to do with the election coming up. And so, of course, those two are not related, and they keep extrapolating those comments that Trump made. And the Obama White House continued to hammer on those comments for months, including after he was elected, that somehow Trump called on the Putin government to hack Hillary Clinton. So, you know, but again, why aren't they talking to the Obama administration, Obama officials, why they didn't do more, why they knew 6-7 months before the election that this was going on, and they did nothing about it. So their explanation that they didn't want to seem biased in the election, and that's why they didn't do anything about it or make a public announcement, that doesn't fly, especially based on what we know was going on at the Department of Justice at the very same time.
Julie Kelly, again, with American Greatness. Listen, thank you so much for coming on the program today. It's good talking with you.
You too. Have a great weekend, Cam.
You too, Julie. We'll talk again very soon. Julie Kelly with us here on Cam and Company. I have just a few minutes left here on the program, but we'll give you a sneak peek. Already Monday's program shaping up quite well, as a matter of fact. We'll talk with David Campbell out of Effingham County, Illinois, member of the board there. You get an update on the number of counties across the state of Illinois that have adopted these Second Amendment sanctuary resolutions that gun control activists now in Illinois are aware of and are responding to and are lying about, as a matter of fact. Mark Walls from the Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence says, while these are this is quote unquote symbolic, it also sends a message to people that these groups think gun ownership is more important than protecting human life. Now, let me ask you a question. Do you really think that these Second Amendment sanctuary policies, these resolutions that counties are offering up that say, hey, you know what, if Springfield passes these gun laws and infringe on our right to keep and bear arms, we're going to tell our local law enforcement, don't enforce those laws. Does that actually send a message that gun ownership is more important than protecting human life? I mean, I know that's what the gun control activists would love that message to be, and that's certainly the message they're going to be selling. These gun owners think that their guns are more important than human life. But if you live in one of these counties that's adopted one of these resolutions, you know. We're not talking about statistics who are owning guns. We're not talking about data points who are owning guns. We're talking about your family members who are gun owners, the people that you work with. Your dentist, your vet, right? These are the gun owners. And why do they own firearms? Well, many of them might own firearms because they're hunters. A lot of them probably own firearms because they care about human life. They want to protect human life. They own firearms for self-defense or the defense of their families. And the gun control advocates say, oh, no, they're just gun owners. They don't care about human life at all. They just care about their inanimate objects. Nope. The reason why a lot of gun owners are gun owners is because they care an awful lot about human life. So we'll talk with David Campbell about the objections of the gun control advocates. Also, Rob O'Donnell is going to be with us from Brothers Before Others, talking about this report out of the city of Chicago, where Mayor Rahm Emanuel, obviously no fan of legal gun ownership, and the city have released their 2017 gun trace report. Yes. All about tracing firearms that were recovered by the Chicago Police Department, and learning more about, you know, where these guns originally came from, trying to learn how they came into the hands of violent criminals. And Rob has been perusing this report. He says, actually, there's a lot of really interesting stuff in here, and stuff that doesn't necessarily align with the narrative of gun control activists. Many of whom, you know, say that Chicago would be like Mayberry as long as the country at large adopts Chicago-style gun control laws. If we all, or another example, if we all had gun laws that looked like Baltimore, Maryland, Baltimore, Maryland wouldn't look like Baltimore, Maryland. I don't know. I don't get it either. We need to pass these ineffective gun control laws at the national level, and then it'll be great. It won't be that the entire country starts to look more like Baltimore or Chicago. Oh, no, no. If we all just pass these gun control laws that aren't working in Chicago and Baltimore and elsewhere, but if we all do it somehow, magically, then they'll work. That's the theory. We'll talk about it with an actual law enforcement officer on Monday's Cam and Company. That music means we've got to go, but thank you so much for being a part of the program today. Enjoy your weekend. I'll have a full report from Bristol coming up on Monday, but don't forget NRARaceTix.com, where you can get your tickets for the Bass Pro Shops NRA Night Race.